Hello and welcome to The Savage Beast. I'm Dan White, aka The Beast Must Die, and I'm here with, as always, Matt Colgate, aka Lord Nuneaton Savage.
Hello.
And we've taken a grim trip through a hard set of movies for this latest podcast. The theme is revenge.
Yeah. If you enjoyed the knockabout humour of the Stephen King podcast and the jocular atmosphere with which we treated all the films, that might be a little bit absent from this.
yeah. It's interesting because one of the things watching all the films that we chose, I was thinking about is that revenge is a really, it's in a way, it's the sort of most simple storytelling device there is. Because it is... You have a terrible act that gives your protagonist license to basically do awful things to people until some sort of ending happens, be it, uplifting or, in most cases, not uplifting. But it's a really, like, mechanical process.
Yeah.
And actually, if you sort of say, what is a revenge movie, the list is... endless. So many films are revenge films.
And even films that you don't necessarily think of as revenge films, you're just like, oh, hang on, that's a revenge-motivated plot. You know, these things don't have to be, like, Death Wish in order for them to qualify as revenge movies. Which I think just goes to show that as a storytelling mechanic, it is as old as storytelling itself. You know, love, hate, revenge, you know what I mean? It's as old as storytelling, so it's always been there in some shape or form. But it's quite interesting, because we watched these four films, and I'd never watched this many revenge movies in a short space of time, not self-consciously anyway. And realising the similarities they all have and the differences they all have. But it got me thinking, like, what's the, like... Because all of these films in their own way are subversions on the revenge narrative.
Yes.
You know, an askew glance at a classic revenge narrative. So what is the classic revenge narrative then? What is the classic film? Because everyone I can think of... Like, I was thinking, oh, is it Point Blank? And I was thinking, well, no, because that's kind of a subversion. Even if it's just mediumistically, that's kind of a subversion of the revenge narrative.
I mean, I think you probably could say something like Birth of a Nation is a revenge narrative.
Or Count of Monte Cristo as well, I was thinking, is one of the classics, isn't it?
If you take it that, you know, essentially it's about the protagonist's kind of taking action against the antagonist because of an action, then something like Birth of a Nation is there. I mean, Birth of a Nation, we're not going to get into that.
No.
We don't need to talk about that.
No, this is depressing enough.
Exactly. But, something like The Searchers could be classed as a revenge.
Yeah.
It is almost every film, in some ways, has this. And what's interesting is the ones we've chosen are quite pared down in their approach. I think the other thing about revenge movies is that they can skew towards juvenile excuses for unpleasantness by giving someone a rationale to be awful. You can then lean into awful acts as kind of, you know, redressing the balance, and it's something that's
the thing is with the sort of the morality aspect of revenge is like, you know, I lost count of the amount of films that we talked about that I looked up before we chose the four, where it was like, but you know, he realises that when he runs with Beast Stan, he becomes a beast himself.
Yeah,
when he looks into the abyss,
it turns out
the abyss looks back into him as well. Yeah. To the extent that it is like, when you're watching revenge films, it's like you almost have to go kind of like, I get that bit. We're just going to ignore that because it's like, it feels like the filmmakers almost have to put it in there as like a get out clause.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, which is what's so refreshing about one of the films we've got on our list tonight, where it's like, revenge is awesome.
Yeah.
Do it as quickly as possible, which makes it a really nice antidote to the other films, which all seem to have this underlying.
And it can feel like such a cop out when you've just watched a film, you know, and, you get some pat thing at the end where it's like, oh, was it worth it? Who knows? Probably not. But wasn't it fun getting there?
Yeah.
You know, it always feels a bit duplicitous and a bit hackneyed.
It's a trifle disingenuous, isn't it? It's like, you've enjoyed this, haven't you?
I mean, for example, at the moment, some of the most popular films are the John Wick films.
Yeah.
I personally am left reasonably cold by the John Wick films.
They're okay.
Because being a snob and a a person of a certain age, I'm like, first of all, you're late with your love of Keanu, all right? Some of us have been there for a long time. And secondly, if you've enjoyed kind of extreme Asian action films, for example, before, then this is the same thing, but given a computer game kind of workover, a modern computer game workover. And I find them to be not quite as awesome as everyone seems to want them to be whenever I watch them, and leave me a little... but they are also a really good textbook example of the most simple, like, yeah. It literally involves a puppy being killed,
yeah,
in order for you to be like, now fuck those people up, please, Keanu, and he does.
Yeah.
But it's so juvenile, and so, I mean, I know it's not just a puppy, but but it is really.
Yeah.
And it feels almost like laughably hollow.
Well, there's a self-awareness to, yeah, that decision.
Exactly.
Making it be a dog that gets killed.
Exactly.
There's a self-awareness, and they're very self-aware films. The second one is the best.
Mm.
The second one's got the best, because the best thing about those films is the world building, it's not the plot. It's basically like reading a really cool role-playing game source book.
Yeah.
And the second film gets that balance right.
And it's got the kind of end-of-level boss thing where it's like, totally, you know, yeah, you keep getting to the next guy, and, you know, and there's been a couple of other films. The Raid is it's not, that's not a revenge film, but it's got that same sort of work your way through the baddies, yeah, until you get to the end of level boss.
Yeah.
The Night Comes for Us.
Yeah.
An extraordinary film, which we are going to deal with it. We're trying to work out at what point we talk about that film,
yeah,
because it needs to be the right kind of the right theme.
It's a hell of a thing.
But it's a hell of a movie. Right. Yeah. I'm not going to talk about it now, but yeah, similarly. But yeah, it's a perennial thing in cinema. It is always popular. And as you say, what's interesting about the ones we've chosen is that they take the basic theme and then they do something with it. And I think what we're interested here is the kind of flavour, feeling and kind of atmosphere,
yeah,
that they dwell in, and what they're doing with that kind of revenge narrative, which is as simple and as old as time.
What's fascinating is seeing when you watch a bunch of films like this, you know, thematically connected in short succession, is that what becomes interesting is not the plot, it's how it's presented. Mm. It's the, you know, the plot's the skeleton, and it's the covering they hang over the skeleton to make it its own beast. That was a horribly mixed metaphor, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
And so therefore it becomes as much an exercise in really just focusing on films, on the language of film, on camera work, on,
yeah,
how you know, characters, actors, how things are placed and produced. So it's been really interesting seeing that and just looking at it. I've been able to watch all of these films from a very much sort of purer film perspective.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And that's been really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So shall we...
Let's crack on.
Okay, so we're going to start with Jeremy Saulnier's Blue Ruin from 2013.
I know this is personal. That's how you'll fail.
I'd forgive you if you were crazy, but you're not. You're weak.
Hello. It's me. By my count, that's two of yours and two of mine. I don't know how this ends.
That's how this works, man. The one with the gun gets to tell the truth.
Yeah.
I think this is a terrific film.
It is.
You know, we've talked about Saulnier on the programme before. We were going to talk about him. He was definitely on the list for talking about on our sort of favourite current crop of directors programme a few programmes ago. But we were sort of like, I think we'd rather give him his own show in some respects. There's something about him that he's a bit of a cut above. There's a temperament to his work that is straight here from the off in his first feature.
I was going to say, I mean, I remember watching Blue Ruin with fairly kind of, you know, green. I didn't know much about it. I remember sort of it getting talked about in the festival circuit, people kind of name checking it.
Did you see it before or after Green Room?
I saw it before.
Right, yeah, same. Yeah. I wonder if that would have meant giving me a different reaction if I'd seen it after.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, what I remember thinking is, not since the Coen brothers, and then, you know, have I watched something where the confidence and the sure-footedness of it was just there from frame one. It's an utterly sort of perfect sort of construction that is completely gripping and utterly compelling and just feels completely like he knows what he wants to do and he achieves it.
Because that's the really interesting thing about this film. This is the third time I think I've seen it.
Mm.
And it's really interesting watching it again and being a little bit more detached from it and realizing what a fucking thrill ride this film is. There is always something happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It doesn't waste a moment. There is always, he's just, the main character, we should probably explain a bit about the film, it's basically, Macon Blair plays this guy called Dwight. He's a homeless guy whose basically life has completely fallen apart since his parents were murdered.
Mm.
He hears from a kindly police officer that the person who murdered his parents is being released.
Yep.
And he goes out to take revenge. He goes out to kill him, basically. And it's no giveaway to say he succeeds in killing this man.
Yep.
And then everything just spirals further and further and further out of control, just further beyond his reach. To the extent that you realise that this is not something he is cracked up to do. This is not something he is capable
of. I think if you're going to sort of say, what's the sort of elevator pitch? It's like, what would you or I be like tasked with a revenge kind of narrative? Because he is physically unprepossessing. He's not a complete badass. No. He's not trained
or
in martial arts
at all.
No,
he's just he does not have a particular set of skills.
Yeah, and when we first encounter him, he's, you know, he looks like he could be in a sort of mid-2000s American indie band. He could be in, like, you know, one of these sort of sub-national style bands because he's got an enormous woolly beard. We first encounter him actually having a bath, but it turns out he's having a bath in someone else's house.
That's amazing. That's,
I mean, this film is incredible because it starts and there's a good 10-15 minute stretch at the start where not a word is spoken, where he literally hops out of this bath because he hears the people whose house he's squatting in coming home, jumps out the window and essentially just kind of naked and just kind of runs. And we see him then, you know, where he spends his time, which is living essentially rough, you know, under a boardwalk on a beach, sleeping in his car, reasonably self-sufficient, but we're definitely immediately in the realms of, you know, this is not someone living their best life. He's got an extremely soulful presence, Macon Blair. He's got a hangdog, worn down expression that, even though he's probably only in his 30s, he sort of seems much older. But it's an incredible sort of start to a film because you've got to sort of take yourself back to when you first saw it and you just have no idea what's going on. And as you say, narratively, we're introduced to the idea, but Saulnier really is a master of minimalist information giving. Like, he relies on short exchanges of fairly elliptical dialogue and doesn't have, you know, he doesn't like it. Even though his storytelling is incredibly clear and concise, he doesn't kind of lead you in and go, this is the story, here's the morals. You just kind of, you find out almost alongside the characters what's happening. And so you follow this guy, you're not sure if he's a good guy. Is he a good guy? Am I following someone who's in the right?
Yeah.
You feel like he is, probably.
Well, because he's your main protagonist, basically, as much for that as for anything else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You're like, we're with this guy, you know, whatever happens. The interesting thing about the sort of the morality or the lack of it in this film that I like is that it's very accumulative.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's really only in the sort of the last scenes where you do get this thing where it's like, oh, that's what that film is really about.
Yeah.
I never felt grabbed by the hand or hit over the head with it, because his camera works very observational. Do you know what I mean? He does this thing where his cameras just sit and watch.
It's quite static.
Yeah, very static. And that gives you this real sort of like voyeuristic kind of feel to it. So to sort of like hit the message any harder would have felt almost kind of inappropriate.
Yeah.
Because it starts so observational and you're basically just following this schlub as he just goes from fuck up to fuck up to fuck up. The staticness of it also, it means you're at a remove. You can't go in there and, you know, you feel so far away from him, you can't go, mate, just stop doing this.
Yeah.
It gives you a sense of how far away he is from any sense of sound judgment.
Sure, yeah.
And that's something that's really interesting about his filmmaking generally. Like, even Green Room, which on the face of it, a much more frenetic film, which we love that film. That'll be in our punk rock episode, I think, music episode, won't it? Even then, it's a much more frenetic film, but it's still very static, very observational.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? Like, taking in the rooms that they're in. Like, and there's something about that that really gives this kind of real sense of utter hopelessness to Blue Ruin. Like,
yeah, Saulnier is kind of a nihilist who doesn't wallow, I think.
Yeah.
His films are, like, the words that come up in every review are like lean,
yep.
Mean often,
yep.
But there's a sort of bleakness to them all, you know, culminating in Hold the Dark, which is one of the bleakest films of all time.
That is such a strange film.
It's really odd, yeah. And in Blue Ruin, you know, what's great is that it's a propulsive narrative told incredibly economically and efficiently and effectively, that nonetheless is incredibly, you know, depressing.
Yeah.
Because of the sort of inherent pointlessness of these kind of, yeah. these squabbling families and their sordid revenge saga.
But you there's nothing operatic about Blue Ruin at all, is there? The score's practically non-existent, as far as I can remember. I can't really recall anything jumping out.
The bad guys are, you know, what are they? Are they a crime family? They seem like they're essentially like low-level criminal sort of types.
Yeah.
But there's no real sense that they're like monsters who must be stopped. You know.
No, there's no sense of, there's very little sense of the righteousness. We never meet his parents. We never know what was taken away from him. We meet his sister.
Yeah.
He immediately gets into way more trouble than she's ever been in her life.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, just from being around this walking disaster bent on revenge. But it's really, there's so many great little choices. Like, I loved the way in this film, like at the beginning when he first kills the guy, and when you see him on the boardwalk and stuff, he's got this, as you say, he's got this very sort of indie rocker kind of vibe, and it eases you into the film in a way, because you can almost buy that this hairy wild man would be capable of stabbing someone in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And then when he goes and takes the shower and shaves the bath off, and he comes out, that's the moment.
He's wearing a short sleeve shirt, and he's got a shaved face,
and you get, it's Macon Blair's face.
Yeah.
You're all of a sudden like, there is nothing animalistic about this man at all. Even the little sense of belief I had in him being able to do what he's just done, it was enough to carry me through. If they'd started it with him clean shaven,
you'd have got clearer what the...
And it would have been a lot harder to buy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's just one of the interesting little decisions that they make in this film, where really you're just like, that was incredibly smart, economical piece of storytelling.
No, it's
a reveal, you know.
And the other thing we should mention about this film is that it also ushered in the new, well, it's one of the films that I think kind of ushered in this new wave of cinematic violence, which is incredibly real and sudden and violent and brutal, but not in any way kind of glamorized, but it does nonetheless clearly enjoy, you know, blood and violence as a cinematic trope, as a thing that you put in your films. There is a sort of gleefulness to the violence.
Completely. It comes from a horror background as much as anything else, but you're right, it's basically just removes all the kung fu.
Yeah, exactly. When people get hit with bullets, they're hit wherever, they're hit in the neck or the cheek or the face, and that, you know, they're just, their heads come apart, but it's not
his,
you know,
brilliantly random approach to violence is definitely, and what it does to human, but well, there's actually a bit in this film, isn't it, he comes across a friend, doesn't he? He's brilliantly played.
Yeah, so he goes to see a friend.
But he's not even really a friend.
He's his old high school friend who he tracks down, who's now like a bouncer at a heavy metal club, a punk rock club. And this guy has an arsenal of weaponry, and he's clearly a sort of rugged survivalist type. But he's also like a bit of a nerd.
Yeah.
He's kind of a nerdy guy. But what I love about it...
It's a really great portrait. It's a really compelling portrait.
And what I love about it is the way that his friend just helps him unequivocally. And he helps him because he's his old friend. And that's the only reason he helps him. But he's also incredibly pragmatic. He's the guy that if it was him, this revenge story would pan out completely differently.
Yeah.
And he helps him, you know, in a number of ways. But what's kind of great about it is that you get this sort of proficiency without ever descending into, you know, like ridiculous, like, oh, this guy's a complete
he doesn't like teach him how to use nunchucks or anything,
and you don't get a feeling he's a good guy. He's a guy who lives on his own and has tons of weapons and clearly is a bit,
it's a really compelling little character sketch. But yeah, you're right, the sort of pragmatism that comes off him, there's that bit where he this gentleman shoots one of these low-level criminals. And Macon Blair's is just this, you know, and his, you know, the bullet hits him and his face, like half his face fucking comes off. It is really just and it comes out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah,
it's like, wow, okay. And Macon Blair's just like his face, and he's just like, that's what guns do, you know.
Yeah.
And that is totally what's on
the edge. When they pick the body up and put it in the trunk, and he says, what about the rest of his face? And he just says, like, the coyotes will get that. Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
But he's also like, let's get him off my property. I'd like him off my property, you know, all this stuff. So, but
and the way he has to shoot him to make it legal and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. Yeah. I had to wait until he was pointing a gun at you, and then I took him out.
Yeah.
But there's also a bit, you know, probably the most memorable bit early, apart from the initial kind of killing of the you know, the bad guy at the start. There's a bit where he gets hit by an arrow.
Oh, it's amazing.
And he breaks the arrow off. And what we get is a very prolonged and extremely uncomfortable sequence of, like you say, someone like you or I trying to essentially pull a fucking arrowhead out of his leg.
Like he's seen in the film.
And he's brought some like rubbing alcohol or something. He's going to pour it on it. And he thinks he's going to basically patch himself up. And it's agonising and awful.
And then it smash cuts to him collapsing outside a hospital as well.
That's the one like at laugh out loud moment is he just turns up at the hospital and he's just like, I've done something stupid or something. I've had an accident. But that was the bit when I first watched it where I was like, oh, this film is bringing it.
Yeah.
That is a really hardcore sequence. And it's like, now actually we're in a few years on, when we say it's 2013, 7 years ago, and in that time this sort of level of like brutality, like realistic brutality, has become very much a part of a lot of kind of action films. And you know, you still got your Fast and Furious style ridiculousness, but this film for me is like one of the poster sort of children of that new school brutality.
It's really interesting watching True Detective season 3, wasn't it? Because Saulnier was initially he was tapped to do the lot, and then I think he fell out with the guy that writes
Nicholas
Pizzolatto, who seems to, let's just say, he seems to fall out with a lot of people he works with.
He seems to have an interesting relationship to other people's texts as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, definitely. I've read his novels, you can kind of tell. They're a bit unbearable, actually. But it was really interesting watching the shootout in season 3 of True Detective, and like, Saulnier didn't direct that episode, but how much it looked like a Saulnier shootout.
Well, it's incredible that it sits alongside, it's almost identical to the astonishing shootout in Hold the Dark, and yet it isn't. It came out kind of, I'm not sure which, when it came out, but concurrently, pretty much,
yeah. So it's very strange. Yeah. Like, I would love to know what happened there.
Yeah, whether he sort of storyboarded it, or maybe he'd even directed that much of it or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think that's one of those sort of Hollywood things where, you know, the story will probably come out in 10 years' time in Variety Nick Pizzolatto.
What a shame as well, because, I mean, actually, season 3 of True Detective turned out to be a fucking amazing.
I loved it.
Bit of telly.
Absolutely loved it.
You know, but again, we don't need to get into that. Mm. But
It's really interesting. It's interesting, like, even on that level, you can start seeing this stuff in like primetime TV. This level of kind of like how violence is presented starts.
Absolutely, being.
And it's you're right. There's this kind of like earnestness to the depiction of violence a lot of the time now, particularly in sort of more sort of serious.
And the suddenness of it. Yeah. You know, there's no preparation for when a bullet hits you.
Yeah.
You know, you're just, that's it. You're out. And one of the things that, having seen Blue Ruin, then going into Green Room and knowing what the concept of Green Room was, is one of the most tense experiences in my life, just watching Green Room, waiting for it to go off, because you knew the violence was going to be really fucking horrid.
Yeah,
and it really is.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing, that film. The first shock bit of violence in that film, where he pulls his hand back in from the door, is one of, you know, I've never heard a cinema audience so audibly
gasp. Of,
like, it was just like everyone was just knocked flat by that.
Yeah. But Blue Ruin is interesting as well, because, you know, it does subvert a number of things in the revenge story. One of the things that happens halfway through is one of the guys who he's captured, one of the family members who he's captured, essentially is like, it wasn't the guy you killed isn't the guy who did it. And we're never clear whether that is or isn't the case.
Yeah.
And we never find out. I mean, there's some hints and there's some suggestions. There's certainly some suggestions that, you know, the family are definitely shitheels.
Mm.
But it undercuts. And the moment that he realises he's maybe just killed someone innocent, not innocent, but certainly not guilty of the crime with which he decided to, you know, take retribution on, he just looks completely fucking broken.
Yeah.
Like, oh, fucking hell, you know. And that's a really nice subversion halfway through a film, to just enter the idea, maybe he just killed the wrong guy.
Yeah, and you know, just subtly says, yeah, this is all totally pointless.
Yeah, like, and the final shootout involves him versus two women.
Yeah.
one of whom is like a mother.
Yeah,
you know, it's like yeah. it's really anticlimactic in its way. You know,
it very much reminds me of the final gunfight in Taxi Driver. Actually,
yes.
It's got that kind of vibe where it's just yes. like, oh, is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Really violent, really squalid, really quick.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, we're done. You know, and that's how this violence plans out yeah. in the real world. You know,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it just that sense of just like utter hopelessness at the end.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, why did that all just happen? That was so easily avoidable.
Yeah, and sometimes when I watch films like that, I kind of can feel not just gypped, but actively aggravated because yeah. I feel like it was an excuse just to do horrid things with no point.
Yeah.
You know, and the Coen brothers, I know I've raised them before, but one of their hallmarks is. It's all about, you know, circles and holes, their
yeah.
stories. Everything's sick, circular. Nothing ever means anything. No one's ever done the thing they were actually accused of. No, there isn't any money. There's no, the money gets lost. You know, there is no mystery. They love that kind of anti-narrative sort of pointlessness. But because watching a Coen Brothers film is the joy of actually watching a film, that's
yeah.
the fun of it. That's how they get away with not making you feel completely like, oh, fuck you.
Yeah.
And I think Blue Ruin has a similar thing where the sheer skill and just confidence with which he does his, you know, tells the story means that you don't mind the fact that it is essentially a squalid little pointless revenge narrative.
It never comes across as cheap.
And it doesn't,
it,
yeah.
It's quite strange that for probably the film on our list with almost the most classic exploitation plot, the simplest revenge exploitation plot, it's actually the least exploitative.
Yes.
I never felt like I was being manipulated by this film. I felt perfectly guided along, allowed to make my own decisions. Like I say, at one remove from everything. I never felt like I was being bullied emotionally or forced into a certain point of view. It's very placid, much like the character of Macon Blair's character himself. It's a very placid presence in the middle of a shitstorm of violence.
Yeah.
You know, and that's there's something about that that's incredibly compelling.
You know? And it's interesting because, like you say, Saulnier is like deeply steeped in exploitation, you know, filmmaking. And he clearly is a fan, a real fan of that stuff. And yet he's not a fanboy.
Mm.
He doesn't make films that sort of are consciously aping things you've seen before. They feel incredibly singular and of their own. You know, there are possible, you know, precedents you can say, well, maybe it's a bit like that. But really, they feel fairly fully formed.
Yeah.
He's never pastiching. He's never, you know, they feel thrillingly contemporary and all that, you know, while similarly being quite sort of 70s and classical in their sort of approach. But he makes exploitation films, and yet he doesn't feel like a tourist because he's not going to go, oh, let's just throw in a really gratuitous rape, or let's have some nudity in
or some kind of recognisable guest star.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he never winks at you, does he?
So it's interesting that he it's almost like he's more true to some of the sort of early pulp sort of exploitation writers and filmmakers in that he's actually quite serious-minded in his intent.
Yeah.
He's not playing stuff for laughs, and he's not trying to kind of get a kind of high five from the audience, which is kind of what's happened with the post-modern exploitation fair.
Yeah,
there's always this feeling like someone is like dwelling in that region, whereas this feels more like a low budget thriller that he's ploughed everything into making as gripping and sort of tight as he can.
Yeah.
And it is, let's be honest, I mean, there's about six people in this film.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Watching it this time, I was really noticing how incredibly elegant it is at using its very low budget. You know, it's shot beautifully. His cinematography is wonderful, and he's got a real kind of master of like you say, shots and construction and pacing and all that stuff. But it's a low budget film.
Yeah,
you know, it's small in its scale, it's small in its intent, and it's small in its delivery, and yet it feels utterly cinematic.
Mm. It's strange. It's a film that like could have been pretty much written in any time in the last 50 years,
yeah.
but it could only really be made now.
Yeah.
It does feel very contemporary.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the way it looks, the way it's put together, feels, yeah, like you hinted at earlier, very modern, very sort of contemporary, very of its moment, but still using this very classic storytelling device. You know, and it's like what I was saying about it's how people hang the baggage on these things.
Yes.
The time. And his style is elegant.
Yeah.
He's a supremely elegant filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's gory and he's violent and he doesn't play his shit for laughs, but at the end of the time, there's a streamlined sense of elegance and unfussiness.
Yeah, he's not going to sort of prolong a sequence of violence just to go, let's enjoy this for a while. But he is also going to say, I want to show you how much blood someone loses when you try and pull an arrowhead out of a leg.
Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna, and that's the other thing is that one of the things that unites almost all these films is depictions of blood leaving wounds is just a thing that is just like, what, as you say, watching four of these in a row,
yeah.
I was just like, after a while, I just was like, I'm going to lose my lunch if I watch another head wound or a fucking arterial spray or that slow glug of thick blood out of a like nasty wound is just like,
the stain on the trouser leg. Yeah, there's been a hell of a lot of that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it's an impeccable film, really, Blue Ruin. I think probably Green Room that I like probably more, just because I think it is. I don't
necessarily say that Green Room is a better film. I think they're pretty much par for par on that one. But Green Room, because of its subject matter and the way it's handled, is always going to appeal to me more.
I think it's more actively terrifying. Yeah. I think Green Room is one of the most tense films I think I've ever sat through.
Yeah.
And Blue Ruin has its moments of real tension and unpleasantness and stuff. But it's also got there's a curious pleasure in just watching the sort of prosaic way with which he's going about things. And that's right at the start, him, taking a bath in someone else's house, going through the dumpster, trying to get some food, reading his book in his car, all this stuff.
It's all good character work.
But it's quite pleasant. It's not pleasant, but it's quite fascinating watching someone kind of going about it and then going to, a hardware shop to buy the stuff he needs to kind of try and remove the arrow from his leg and going to see his friend who's going to help him out and the pragmatic way his friend is listing the different weapons he might use, and
there's a sort
of spends time on that stuff.
There's almost a kind of travelling hobo vibe about it.
Yeah.
Sort of bimbles from one situation. Because like I say, the amazing thing about this film is, like, considering the kind of meditative film it is, it's all action.
Yeah.
There's every scene something really cool or interesting or terrifying happens.
Yeah, no.
It's a really fucking good film.
I mean, I going out on a limb, I'd say Saulnier is the most exciting filmmaker that I can think of in the last 10 years, and he's certainly the person that I will literally watch anything the fucker makes. He's gonna have to make some severely bad films before I don't invest heavily in his stock.
He's earned his place in the heroes.
I love watching a film by someone where you're like, this guy fucking gets it. This person knows how to make films.
See, I need to rewatch Hold the Dark because I really enjoyed that film. But I did leave it going a bit like, what the fuck?
Yes.
As I think a lot of people did. And I need to watch it again, maybe knowing that that's
I've watched it twice, and I still need to watch it again.
Apparently, and we're going a bit off topic here, but I'm sure our audience won't mind, it's based on a book that goes a lot more metaphysical.
Mm.
And according to someone I know who's read it, he kind of basically just took all the metaphysical bits out, so that actually there's no explanation there, really.
It's a film. Hold the Dark is a film that hints at sort of otherness and other, a sort of a quasi supernatural feeling,
in a very similar way to
stripping it right back, and
similar
not
way to the first
you...
True Detective, actually.
Yeah,
funnily enough.
Yeah, yeah. No, they are incredibly simpatico. Those two things. So I mean, Blue Ruin is just is an extremely classy way to start off this sordid episode. And I think the next film we're going to talk about, which continues in a sort of realist revenge style, is...
Well, we're going to talk about Shane Meadows' Dead Man's Shoes from 2004.
What are you doing, lad?
That's my concern.
Not me in my house. Where are you staying?
Moxon's farm. Gonna come and see me, are you?
Maybe I will. You're not afraid of me, are you? Make me very nervous, Richard.
Well, you should be.
If I were you, I'd get in that fucking car and I'd get out of here, man. And I'd gather them goonies and get whatever you've got and come with me. Because I'm going to fucking hit you all.
I don't like being threatened, Richard.
I'm not threatening you, mate. It's beyond fucking words. I watched over you when you were asleep and I looked at your fucking neck. And I was that far away from slicing it. You're fucking there, mate. So get in that car and fuck off. You get to me first.
Just wait.
Yes, so...
Ah, so interesting watching this film again.
Yeah, so I remember when this came out being quite excited. So we should say, it's Shane Meadows is a British filmmaker who is kind of like Ken Loach meets a kind of more of a genre flavour. Like his
films, he likes his westerns, doesn't he?
He likes...
Like his film before this was Once Upon a Time in the East.
Yeah, and he made a series called This Is England, which is kind of... memories of his childhood growing up turned into an ongoing drama.
I've
about
never seen
people.
The series actually.
Yeah,
I've heard it's really good.
Yeah,
the film. The film's great.
But right. he's got more of a sort of genre flavour to how you know Loach is very much just social realism, and Meadows brings that social realism to his films, and he sets everything in North. Is it Northampton?
Around
no
about.
Nottingham.
Nottingham. Yeah.
And
Midlands, basically.
He really clearly is interested in using his local area as the backdrop for his film.
Yeah.
But Dead Man's Shoes was, you know, I was quite excited about when it came out because it was a kind of like, it's a kind of revenge narrative. People talked about Get Carter, when they were talking about it, because it was very much an explicitly a kind of genre piece, really. Mm. So Dead Man's Shoes deals with a ex-soldier, Richard, who is returning to his hometown to...
Played by Paddy Considine.
Yes, who we'll get to. Who is returning to his hometown to essentially find the truth about what's happened to his younger brother, who we also see alongside him. Mm. He spends most of his time with his younger brother. And what it turns out is that something has happened to his younger brother and a bunch of local... ne'er-do-wells, drug dealers, sort of low-life.
Very, very low quality.
The lowest quality low-life have...
If you grew up in a rural town, you know exactly the type of people
absolutely.
That we're talking about here.
Like. And, you know, have done something awful, and he takes revenge upon them, and it is like Blue Ruin, it's incredibly simple. There is nothing unsurprising in the way that it pans out in a way, but... The pleasures of this film, as far as I see them, are entirely about the English rurality of what's happening.
Yeah.
Like, it is so, as you say, if you've grown up in a small country, town or village or whatever, you know these people.
Yeah.
You know this world. And both you and I did. Mm. And it feels incredibly familiar, whilst being, you know, a particularly squalid example of it, you know. The bad guys in this film feel like the kind of DOS bags who used to score weed off.
Yeah.
You know.
No, completely, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting watching this in comparison to Blue Ruin, isn't it? Because, like, in Blue Ruin, you've got this very sort of low-key, centred approach on a character that is completely unsuited to his task. Mm. He's a total schlub.
Mm.
And in this film, you've got a low-key, harsh approach to a character who is a complete badass.
Oh God, yeah!
Like Paddy Considine in this film, Richard. You know, we get the feeling, we know he's been in the services. I think they say paras at one point, don't they?
Yeah.
And he fucks these people up in ways that are creative, imaginative, utterly without any remorse whatsoever. No enjoyment is taken in it.
And he's not ever presented as you never feel like. He's in danger.
Mm.
It's really interesting watching it. You know these guys are outclassed, and it's the way he responds to them.
Yeah.
He is 100% unafraid. And what's terrifying about him is you begin to realise is that, first of all, he's an incredibly damaged person.
Mm.
And second of all, he is purely nihilistic. He is only... This is what he's going to do, and then that's all he's doing.
Yeah.
He doesn't have anything beyond this. And it's an incredibly bleak film. It's also fascinating because it's 15 years old, give or take, and it feels it actually.
Yes.
It feels like it's come from a different.
It's
time.
Got a very, I mean, just because of the way it's shot and his influence, by saying, you know, it feels like Kez. It's got that sort of like, you know, British 70s murk to it.
Yeah, it could almost be on telly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not...
This is the interesting thing about this film. Like, this was a big film when it came out. I remember this film was on telly a lot.
Yeah.
Like, my girlfriend at the time, she'd seen it and I hadn't. People watched it. Loads of people watched this film.
Yeah, and it had a sort of iconic red poster with a silhouetted guy with an axe, and it seemed like we were still in that kind of post-Tarantino milieu, really.
And post-Trainspotting as well.
Post-Trainspotting,
you know?
Like Cool Britannia style. Yeah. You know, this was the latest cool British... thriller that could go toe-to-toe with a kind of American film,
which
you
it
know,
can, I think,
which it
yeah.
can, but it's such a parochial film.
Yeah, yeah. It's despite the fact that apart from the sort of the main guy Paddy Considine and his brother and you know the people he's fucking up, there's virtually no characters in this film at all. It's literally just them.
Just a few people in the background of a pub or in the local
and occasionally,
shop.
Occasionally he's sleeping in this old farmhouse, isn't he? And you sort of, and like all the shots around there, it's like, yep, I grew up somewhere very close to that. You really get a sense of like the location, despite the fact there's practically no other incidental characters in the film at all. You really get a sense of like where this film is, the kind of lives these people lead, just from seeing them smoking bongs on the sofa.
And,
you know?
And the baddies are basically a bunch of like, you know, just drug dealers, really. Yeah. They're nothing more than that. There's one guy who's the sort of notional badass.
Played by Gary Stretch.
Yeah.
Former boxer, Gary Stretch. And it must be said, there is a bit in this film where he's looking at Paddy Considine and he just goes, "You're not scared of me, are you?" And Paddy Considine actually does look a little bit scared.
Yeah.
To be fair, because it is fucking Gary Stretch threatening you. But like, that man could punch his way through a meat truck.
Yeah. You know? And his face looks like he's gone toe-to-toe with a few meat trucks.
He's gone toe-to-toe with like.
But what I love about these guys is that they're just such a grab bag. So you've got like one guy who's just like an old guy.
Yeah.
And he's like really unpleasant, but he's just an old guy. And then there's like a fat bloke in a suit.
Yeah.
And then there's like the guys in their track suits and they're like, you know.
You've got the sort of like really kind of like ratty faced, just like pure reggae
greasy
listening stoner guy,
yeah.
You know.
And you know, you start off and there's something, like a lot of these films, there's something immensely satisfying about seeing like Richard kind of take them out in a way.
Well, you're given hints as to what happened to his brother throughout the film.
It gradually unveils
in what I
happened.
Think are actually a couple of the weaker moments for me in this film.
I think the motivation for what they do is unclear.
Yeah,
and it stretches believability a bit in what the final denouement is.
Yeah,
feels a bit forced. I feel they could have got there a better way.
Yeah.
That's aged quite badly, I think.
I think it feels very stylistically appropriate to the time. Mm. Actually, I remember sort of like that. There's one shot in particular where it's like it's Paddy Considine's face when he's still in his army uniform after there's just, you know, and it's all black and white, and they've done this sort of false scratching on the screen, this sort of false Super 8 thing.
Yeah.
And you look at that now, and I'm like, oh, that looks quite cheap. That doesn't look very good. But I think at the time, I think that's something that a few people were doing. I don't remember feeling that the first time I watched it.
But what's really fascinating about this is that it spends a lot of time. You spend a lot of time with these guys, and actually you begin to sort of warm to them.
Yeah.
And so as you're simultaneously finding out that they have done something very bad.
Yeah.
And that they do sort of deserve what's coming in a way. Mm. it's very cruel what they do.
They deserve something.
They deserve something.
What they get.
But you begin to sort of see them more as what they are, which is a bunch of feckless stoners, largely. Who live on the breadline and, you know, don't have huge amount of outlet for anything. And, you know, this whirlwind of appalling retribution that they get begins to feel really just hard to watch and hard to sort of take. And you feel sorry for them eventually, you know.
Which is totally part of the game.
The
That's
bit
totally
where
part of the game
he, the kind of centrepiece where he takes out, you know, three of them, by spiking them with an incredible amount of drugs is still an outstanding and unpleasant sequence.
As almost an aside, what do you think of the trip scene in this film?
I think it's great.
It's really good.
I think it's...
I saw him interviewed and he was like, you know, so, you know, how did you go about doing that? He was just like, I wanted to make a classic trip sequence.
Yeah.
I wanted to make one that, you know, because there's a lot of them in film and I like a lot of them and some of them are really terrible. He's like, I wanted to make a fucking classic. I think he gets very close here.
Yeah.
There's one shot in particular of one of the guys where he's just like, the camera's over his head and he's just leaning back on the sofa and it's just his eyes are just enormous and the camera's just going in and out and I'm like, that's it.
Yeah.
They've absolutely got
and
it
it's
there.
Like the sort of the feeling of like just breathing, but also what's really, you know, like just kind of like trying to cope with what's happening by breathing.
Yeah.
But there's what it does really brilliantly as well is because he appears to them all when they are spiked on the most astonishing level of like acid and coke and MDMA
speed,
and everything.
Yeah.
He's given them like a fucking terrifying dose. And so the way that he appears means that he's kind of simultaneously like killing them and they're just unable to stop him. And in fact, one of the guys is almost like smiling.
Yeah.
He's like, because he's sort of like, I don't quite know what's happening. And what's actually happening is his friend's just had his nose pushed through his brain.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a really, that I have to say, watching this time, I remember sort of going to the cinema and thinking, yeah, this is going to be like a cool kind of Brit revenge thing, and being like, yeah, I'm going to enjoy this, and actually, you know, coming out and being a bit like, oh yes, no, actually, turns out it was, you know, it wasn't as satisfying, and oh yes, yeah, isn't, is it a bit bleak? But this time, the bleakness really hit me hard, and I just felt thoroughly miserable by the end.
I really like the feeling this film leaves me with, that sense of just kind of like filthy, slight complicity, slight feeling of guilt for having enjoyed some of it as much as I have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the like I say, the way he takes violence on these people is like a knife through fucking tracing paper. He's just absolutely relentless. And you'd think that wouldn't sustain a film, but the fact he manages to make that sustain an entire movie is really impressive.
But it
keeps being satisfying, even as you're kind of going, oh God, I really shouldn't be enjoying this as much as I am. And I really like that. I think that's a really complicated, clever thing to leave a viewer with. And it does it in such a kind of unpretentious way. You know, it's very matter of fact, this film.
Yes, I mean, it is... It's the most... It's the most British thing. It really is. It's such a British film. What I should say as well is Paddy Considine is astonishing in this film.
He's amazing.
And he's someone who came out of the gate strong, worked with some great people, was in a number of, you know, he was in a
couple of... Well, he wrote this as well.
Yeah, and he was in a couple of Meadows' other films. He was in Room for Romeo Brass. He was in 24 Hour Party People. He's wonderful in that.
I could watch, literally... just the Rob Grattan story, if it was just Paddy Considine playing Rob Grattan for the entire thing, I would watch he's the best thing in one of my favourite ever films.
I love that movie. My favourite line in that entire film is delivered by him, where he says to, it's the story of Factory Records and Tony Wilson, he says, "The problem with you, Tony, is you don't know what you are, but I know what you are. You're a cont."
his reaction is like, well, so you're wrong, because I did know that.
I mean, 24 Hour Party People is a wonderful film.
I love that film.
But Considine came out strong and was very much kind of like the great hope of British cinema for a while. And I have to say, I've seen him in a couple of things and he's been downright bad. I think he is bad in World's End, the Edgar Wright film.
Right, that's interesting. I'd need to watch that again with that in mind, actually.
He just doesn't sit well in that world of, like, comedy. He comes across... I don't know. I just remember watching it thinking, I don't think you're very good in this, actually.
He's great in...
Possibly because his character isn't great, but he's just the other guy.
He is great in Hot Fuzz. I love him in Hot Fuzz.
Let's not fuck with Hot Fuzz. No one... That's a perfect film, so... but it was nice to go back and watch this and go, oh, yeah, he's amazing. Because... The way that he decides to play Richard, first of all, the first time you see him encounter one of these guys, he's just sat, and the guy walks into the pub he sat in, and his brother says, "That's one of them, Richard." And he just literally just turns around, moves his chair around, and just starts staring at the guy who's just dealing weed or coke in a pub or something, and speed probably. And he's just staring at him, and he's just got this real look on him, and the guy just is like, you know, "What are you looking at, mate?" And he just goes, you cunt, like that. And he fucking just bolts into this, like, scary... And you're like, oh, he's really scary. So that's the first time. But then he doesn't really do that again. That's your little hint that he's, like, a fucking dangerous person. And the guy shits it immediately. Yeah. But then he just has this horrible, soft way of talking to people that's so unsettling. The bit where he's just like, "It's not very nice, is it, mate? No. Do you want to sit down now, do you?"
Yeah.
And it's like the way he's talking in this almost comforting, brotherly way to these people that he's executing is so bone-chilling and so unsettling. And the way that you get the feeling that you're not sure where the damage has begun with him, you know, you understand that his relationship to his brother is complicated. And it's introduced through a number sort of home footage of these two little kids playing together, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But then you begin to understand.
But also very early night, very of its time.
Yeah, yeah.
Footage of kids, scratchy Super 8 footage of kids playing together, used over an emotive, folky soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like very 2004.
Yeah. but as the film progresses, you begin to realise that maybe Richard's relationship to his brother is a more complicated one. That, you know, actually, he was probably a bit ashamed and annoyed by having this, because his brother has learning difficulties, which is a big part of it.
Yeah.
But the thing that I love about it is you also get the feeling that you know, he's served, as you say, as a paratrooper. And there's a good chance maybe he was in the Gulf or something like that. You know, it's certainly that time scale. But you get the feeling that the damage, that he's quite a damaged person, that maybe he's done some pretty bad things as a soldier as well.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. He's not, you know, and so he's damaged and he's scary in the way that people who leave the army sometimes are, you know. Vietnam, people who came back from Vietnam in the Second World War, you know, having lived through certain things, you're then expected to just slot back into life, and understandably people don't always manage that,
yeah,
you know,
a lot of them,
because
don't,
your
yeah.
paradigms have changed, and things you've done and seen things that are just beyond comprehension, and you've seen humanity in a completely different way, and that is hinted at with Richard, but I love the way it just doesn't suggest any more than that.
Yes,
you know, he's just served, so
there's no war flashbacks or anything like that. There's no kind of like overt sense of PTSD, though that is almost inevitably something that he is suffering from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's all done through the way he plays the part, and it's just utterly menacing, utterly chilling, and so far beyond help.
Yeah.
Like, there's literally nothing that anyone is going to be able to say to this guy that's going to stop him doing this, and then, as you say, doing nothing else. He has no he's a man without ambition.
Yeah, this is going to, when this ends, he ends, essentially.
It's really interesting that what I was saying about, like, that these, the films that we've chosen being sort of representatives of different types, because I read a bunch of reviews of this film, and not all positive. I seem to remember people really loving this film, but actually there's a lot of fairly negative reviews, and all of them, all the really negative ones kind of go, it's basically just a second-rate slasher. Now, I know this is a bit of a complaint on my part, because I've done this before. It's like, I don't think this is a slasher movie at all.
No.
I can't think of a slasher. This is a Western.
Yeah.
This film's a Western.
Absolutely.
This man is a you know, former Confederate soldier coming back into town to clean the town up.
It's High Plains Drifter.
Yeah, it's High Plains. You know. It's really interesting. I watched High Plains Drifter 2 weeks before I watched this film, and the parallels are absolutely undeniable. Mm. This film basically is right down to the almost slightly spiritual element to it, that he is basically just almost a ghost.
Yeah,
you know, no
he's
other characters.
Haunted, isn't
yeah, no
he?
Other, yeah. But no other characters appear with him. At any point, you know, and it's like it plays with that, and it, so it does have that kind of like quasi spiritual nature that High Plains Drifter's got. And I wouldn't have got that if I hadn't watched High Plains Drifter the week or so before, because the other film that, and as soon as I worked this out, I was really pleased with myself. The other film that this really riffs on is fucking First Blood. He's dressed exactly like John Rambo.
He is, even
down to the flared
trousers.
Boot cut trousers, 2004. Even down to the boot cut trousers, he is dressed exactly, with the kit bag, he's dressed exactly like John Rambo. And I saw an interview with Paddy Considine, and he's talking about, you know, how the film came together and the kind of film, because he wrote it, as I said. And he's just like, you know, you want to be careful. And then he just sort of starts saying First Blood, and then he stops.
Right.
He stops himself from saying it earlier. It's like, you know exactly what you're doing here. And it's really interesting watching it through that as well. Ex-serviceman coming back to a small town, and basically just, havoc ensuing. It's really interesting.
So the other thing that's kind of interesting in terms of, you know, it's 15 years old, is that his brother, as we say, has learning difficulties, played by Toby Kebbell, who you recognise as Dr. Doom from the Fantastic Four, recent Fantastic Four film.
Did you watch that?
I have seen that.
It's a fascinating dog pile, isn't it?
There's a good film that could have come out of that.
There's a 7 out of 10 film that could have come out of a 2
out of
10.
There's moments of interest in there, but clearly Josh Trank's lost control. But it ends up as one of... It's a terrible, terrible piece of
it's
shit.
It's a boondoggle, isn't it?
But Toby Kebbell, so, you know, this has become a thing that now I just don't think would happen.
No.
In that you've got someone who playing a character with learning difficulties who doesn't have them. And I feel conflicted, because I actually think this is a bit of a quagmire that I don't want to get myself into.
Yeah.
But I personally didn't feel it was, an offensive portrayal.
No.
And I think that... It reminded me of the way that when you're a kid, there's someone in the town who's the brother of someone, or who is the kid.
Yeah.
And you're up the rec and everyone's like, that's John so-and-so. Yeah, he's a whatever. And insert a time-appropriate, insensitive slur name for whatever someone with learning difficulties is. But it feels like that is like, it feels quite like being a kid again, so I totally get that, you know, that it is like you could probably have got someone to play this who, you know, you didn't need to get someone to sort of pretend to have learning difficulties. But I actually think that he does quite... I feel like it's quite a nuanced and good performance.
This is the thing. It's not really for us to say.
Yeah.
And I did... after I watched the film, I did my usual sort of Google trial. I did Google to see if...
Find out if there had any,
you know, made any points about it. And I couldn't find anything.
No. I suspect there aren't many contemporary reviews of it, because it's one of those fascinating films that seems to have dropped off the radar, despite being very, very popular.
Well, we streamed it on YouTube.
Yeah, it
didn't seem to be anywhere and that's bizarre, because, yeah, like you say, this film is popular. Everyone I know has seen this film. I think because it was it's a Film 4 joint, isn't it? So it used to be on Film 4 Sunday evenings all the time. I think it was regularly shown. So I think that's probably part of the reason. But I do remember, like, you know, before I'd seen it, people going, oh man, you need to see that. There's this really fucked up bit where he's wearing a gas mask. I was quite into gas masks in the early 2000s. And I had something of a collection. And so people were just like, yeah, you need to check that out. You'll really, really like it. Yeah, everyone I know seems to have seen it. And now it seems to have just dropped off the map. But I would say this is more so than a lot of films from that period. I think this film's a bit of a fucking classic.
Yeah, me too. I
associate this film, and I think of British filmmaking from that period. I think this is like the first film that pops into my head where I'm like,
Shane Meadows and Michael Winterbottom were among this really interesting sort of slew of British directors at the time who were finding, you know, they were taking inspiration from the sort of 70s British filmmaking. Get Carter is obviously a big name check, and Ken Loach, and we've already said that sort of stuff, but found a way to sort of introduce a contemporary flavour to that whole sort of social realist filmmaking, and make stuff that was inherently cinematic while still having a very
mediumistic,
earthy British feel.
So mediumistically exciting. Yeah. So it's that thing, like, you know, when the first time you see Trainspotting, which if it had been made like 5 years earlier, it would have been made for BBC Two, and it would have been a gritty. And actually, it starts with Lust for Life.
Alan Clark made it.
Whereas actually, you watch it and it's ridiculously pacey and exciting and informed by genre, though it's not a genre film. And I think there's that kind of like a particular sort of like moment in filmmaking where that suddenly becomes feasible over here. And don't get me wrong, stuff like The Full Monty and Brassed Off and Four Weddings and Funeral ended up winning.
Kind of cozy,
you know, because Richard, a lot.
Faux Richard Curtis, you know, world of lovely cosy Britishness
that sort of ended up winning in the end. That ended up becoming our export and not our thrillers, but it was a really interesting little period, because it did films like Shopping and stuff like that comes out of the same sort of like, but I mean, it's awful, but although, you know, the guy did go on to create Event Horizon, so we do need to give up our thanks.
Well, cheers him.
But there's that funny little scene in Dead Man's Shoes for me, although, you know, getting on for 10 years later than Trainspotting, maybe a little less, for me, is the film that epitomises that moment, even more so than Trainspotting. I think there's something very unique about this film that is very specific to the moment it was made and that particular generation of directors.
I think that Shane Meadows, one of his greatest skills, you know, and I think that, you know, we've hinted at what some of the problems are with the narrative and the storytelling, some of the devices. One of his greatest skills is he's remarkable at working with actors and people who are not, you know, non-actors. He often uses non-actors, and, you know, that comes out in the interplay, the sort of the banter between the scumbags is so compelling. Like, I love the bit where basically the greasy-haired guy who gets started on in the pub goes to see his two mates who are also involved, and he goes around. And what they do is he goes around and he's like, this weird thing happened. I think it's Richard. And they're all like, oh shit, it's Richard. You know, they know that, you know, essentially hell is coming. Mm. But they just get really stoned and hang out. And they hang out. And he leaves and he's like, I'm going to go now, boys. And he leaves the house and he goes out, and Richard's stood outside in a gas mask. And he's really like stoned out of his mind, and he just freaks out and runs back into the flat. When he runs back in, they're just like dancing around. One of them's got like an African face mask off that they've obviously got,
playing a little drum,
playing the drums and stuff or something. And they're just
it's just like
this is what happens when your mate's gone and you're still going, and it's just you and your dickhead
where he goes around to the house for the first time, and they're both just really bait reading the letters page from porn mags at each other.
And it's, I mean, just like, that is like, you know,
it's
100%.
So utterly spot on. Yeah, like, I mean, hanging out in those towns is like, that's because that's all you've got to do.
And the way that when we were kids, you know, you'd go, say, you might go and try and score some weed from the local guy who still lived with his mum.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd just hang out in these rooms or whatever, and it'd be like you your mate, some other kids, an old guy,
yeah,
some dude who, like, who's that? Why is he here? You know, and that is like, it's a very
from that
particular flavour.
From that period, like, where you had to sit around a dealer's house for at least an hour before you were allowed to leave, otherwise people would know he was dealing drugs.
Wait until they'd finished watching Blockbusters until you could go, yeah.
There's still eight other people on the sofa with him who'd obviously been there all day.
But, I mean, that to me, watching it this time around, was the stuff I was really vibing off, was like the interplay and the sort of just the... and the convincingness of it, the sort of mise-en-scène, the feeling of that film is really authentic,
and
then to have that contrasted against this really brutal revenge narrative is completely unique.
And the one part where it fell down to me and still falls down for me is the last third
with the guy who is the
sort of guy that's left the gang,
who you don't he pulls an interesting cinematic sleight of hand,
yes,
where he goes, there's one more, isn't there? And then you suddenly get all these flashbacks where he's in it,
yeah,
and you haven't seen him. And
I did find myself at one point,
it's quite an interesting thing
I thought
to
it
do.
Was quite well done,
yeah.
But also, like, so that bit, he confronts the last member of the gang, and
he's a guy with kids, he's married, he's
the way that Richard frames what has to happen next still doesn't convince me, and it never has.
No.
It's never quite worked for me, that. I can see why he'd want to end it up that way.
Yeah.
But he seems to give three or four reasons why it might and not really commit to any of them, just through Richard's speech, just through the way he's behaving, and it still doesn't quite fly.
Yeah.
And also, when you're seeing in the flashbacks what they actually did to his brother, it goes black and white, it goes to the scratchy Super 8 kind of vibe again. And this ridiculously very overbearing choral music is playing.
Yeah.
And it's like it's framing it as almost a sort of religious parable.
Yeah, and
but in a way that just doesn't quite work with the rest of the film. It seems quite out of nowhere.
When they're going to the farmhouse where the act that is, you know, the cause of the whole film happens, yeah, they're sort of parading in a kind of almost like a medieval...
It's very medieval,
You know... what's the word, you know, they're sort of in a line capering, a procession, it starts to feel a bit mannered, and
it almost feels like something out of Field in England.
That was the thing I felt, because
Field in England uses tableaus as well, and it really had that vibe to it, and it was like, normally I would love that, but put with the rest of the film,
it sits
a bit strangely,
and it's not something I think that Meadows has gone back to, actually. I think it's
the moment you can see he's slightly out of his
depth. I agree.
It's the music, and actually the use of music in this film is another thing that really points to its pace in time,
and also the fact that it's a Warp Films co-production, so that he's obviously got access to certain things in a catalogue. What I thought was interesting is he chooses to go down a sort of folk rock, sort of, you know, there's like, I think there's a Bill Callahan song in there.
It starts with Bill Callahan song. I don't know if anyone listens to this. Do you remember the Fence Collective?
Right, yeah.
It's that sort of early noughties Fence Collective style, pensive folk.
And I thought it was interesting, because actually if it was Warp, I mean, I would have been more interested in like Ortega scoring this in a way, or something like that.
It would have been a more psychological approach.
Chris Clark or something, who has ended up doing a lot of score work, would have been quite an interesting choice. But, you know, there's a couple of things that definitely haven't aged great, and, you know, but it is such a, it's such a good film, and it really
Well, that's kind of part of what I say about it, but being very much for me the epitome of that particular time of filmmaking. It's that parts of it haven't aged well, but every time I watch them, I'm like, that's the kind of thing that was happening a lot during that period.
It's interesting as well, because, you know, we mentioned Alan Clark, and I think Alan Clark is another person who actually did take genre fare and infuse it with a really deep sense of Britishness.
Fascinating.
And really had a sense of energy and economy to his film, so he's probably another reference point for someone like Meadows. But also, when you mention Ben Wheatley, I think Ben Wheatley is the product of people like, in a way, like Shane Meadows. Although, you know, I know Down Home his Ben Wheatley's first film, Down Terrace, it probably isn't that far after, it's probably 2008 or 2010, so it's not like he's that, but I feel like without someone like Meadows, you don't really have Ben Wheatley.
Yes.
And Meadows was sort of the bridge between the kind of more social realist kind of BBC Two style thing, and then the more kind of cinematic genre.
It's a crossover point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
so. The Meadows stuff. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a great film though, and sadly hard to get hold of. But yeah,
it's on YouTube. Well worth, like, yeah. I wouldn't normally advise people to watch something on YouTube, but yeah, it's on but YouTube. It's there, that's the only way you're going to see it. It's an okay transfer, so check it out. Yeah, definitely.
So we kind of talked about two films that that are quasi-realist takes the revenge narrative, and we consciously, when we watched these four films, we chose them reasonably randomly, and then when we were talking about them, we realised that they paired up quite nicely. So that's your realist segment, all right? So that's my. We're now moving into the hyper-real segment of the podcast.
It's more real than real,
and this is where shit gets weird. So the next film we're going to talk about...
The next film we're going to talk about, Dan, is Ji-Woon Kim's 2010 revenge thriller, I Saw the Devil. Right, so, I Saw the Devil. Now, I think I probably have to explain why we watched this. I'd heard that this was a really good movie. And I'd been hearing about it for a few years, but I'd also heard that it was, like, extreme.
Yeah.
You know, it's a piece of, you know, Asian extreme cinema. Which, and I was like, I can cope with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been meaning to see it for a while. And then the revenge thing came up and I was like, well, here's the opportunity.
Perfect.
Here's my opportunity to see I Saw the Devil. And I sat down to watch this film, I believe on the same night that you sat down to watch it. And about 20 minutes in, I was like, I cannot believe I'm making Dan watch this. He's got a wife, he's got a child. And it was about 10 minutes in, I was just like, should I? And then I spent almost the entire rest of the film, not to an off-putting sense, I still watched it and took it in, but just all the way through the film I was like, if Mel comes down while Dan's watching this is going to be bad. Like, this is not the kind of thing that escapes a marriage unscathed. This film is noxious.
It is hardcore.
Yeah.
Right. So the thing I would say about I Saw the Devil is, it is incredibly well made.
Fuck yeah.
I mean, I was just marvelling at how proficient and excellent it was. Like, the action is kinetic and exciting. The cinematography is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly composed. The acting's astonishing. It's really well put together. You know, it is... I was trying to think of an equivalent. I mean, it's less overtly stylized, but it's got a sort of De Palma-esque kind of understanding of cinema.
That's a good call, actually.
But it is incredibly harsh and brutal and horrid.
Yeah. Relentlessly, yeah.
Yeah, and there are definitely things that I have some problems with this film about. Do you want to give us the kind of, because there's a sort of elevator pitch which I think kind of explains the film.
So basically in the film are main, you know, you have a protagonist and an antagonist. You know, you have one guy versus one guy in a battle of wits throughout the course of this film. And I'm going to get this one. Byung-Hun Lee plays a policeman whose wife and daughter, just his wife, it's his pregnant wife, isn't it, are abducted by a fucking terrifying serial killer.
Yeah.
He's played by Min Sik Choi, who's the guy from Old Boy, the main character from Old Boy. And his wife, his pregnant girlfriend or wife is murdered horribly.
Yep.
By this man, and then he takes revenge. And because mere revenge would not be enough for the act this man has done, our hero, inverted commas, puts a tracking device on him, so that he makes him eat it, so that basically he can keep capturing him, torturing him, and then releasing him again.
Yep.
So basically he wants to turn this man's life into a living hell.
Mm.
Now, obviously the sense of this idea is disputed quite vigorously through this film, because he obviously continues to go forward and commit these appalling acts.
Yes.
And it's basically, the phrase everyone uses in reviews is cat and mouse game, but there isn't really another one to use. Yeah. It's a cat and mouse game between these.
The Tom and Jerry cartoon.
Yeah, fed
through the grindhouse.
Yeah. With this cop and this serial killer. And it is I mean, this is the only film that we've reviewed for this podcast which I think I would put under the remit of extreme cinema.
Yes.
Like you know, we've watched films that are extreme and we've watched films with loads of violence and stuff like that, but a lot of the time the violence is played for entertainment value. Yeah. The violence in this film is not being played for entertainment value. Or is it? Because it kind of is in some respects, and that's where a lot of the frisson and a lot of my enjoyment of this film actually comes
from. I would say as well that I did enjoy this film. I found it hard, and I found certain elements of it extremely problematic. And I'll say right off the bat that it is a misogynistic film in excelsior. We probably need to get into that a bit more, but it definitely is problematic. And I would have struggled, like you say, I would have struggled mightily if my wife had come in at various scenes in this film. But it is a really good and exciting film.
Yeah.
And there is, of all of the, well... No, of some of the films we've talked about, the previous two have a real sense of the anti-cathartic in The Revenge. This is a film that revels in the cathartic feeling. This guy is such a fucking bad person. He's a serial killer.
He's a
serial rapist murderer who is deeply... I mean, what's great is it's called I Saw the Devil, and he is the devil.
Yeah.
And it gets to that in a way that's really good and visceral. It's just like, this is what happens when you encounter pure, unquestioning and unadulterated evil.
Did you ever read the Nick Cave novel, The Strange Death of Bunny Monroe? Mm. There's an interesting thing I saw him interview. It's a good book, and I saw him, you know, no matter what I think about Nick Cave generally, it's a good book. And I saw him interviewed about it, and he was like, the main character, he wanted to write a main character who was basically exactly like Valerie Solanas, the woman who shot Andy Warhol, personified men in her Scum manifesto.
Mm.
It was like, I wanted to write this story about this man that was literally just an animal of like urge, of just, you know, id and horrible strength. You know, and that's, I was reminded of that when I was looking at watching the Min Sik Choi character.
Yes.
This man is he's a beast.
Yeah.
Like he cannot restrain his urges at all.
No.
You know, if you went, you know, you couldn't go for dinner with him.
He would
shit on the table.
Yeah,
He literally cannot.
You cannot leave a woman in his sight.
Yeah.
No matter what the scenario as well. Even though he is, he realizes that he is being kind of, you know, hunted. He doesn't stop doing what he does.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, there is something also reminiscent of. The Javier Bardem character in No Country for Old Men.
Yes.
In that he just does not stop. He doesn't stop. You cannot stop him. He will not stop. You can fuck him up and it won't stop him. He will continue to just hurt people and kill people and just survive like a cockroach.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a powerhouse performance.
Oh, he's incredible.
You cannot take your eyes off him. And it's one of the things the film consciously does is it gives you an incredibly vanilla... protagonist. I mean, this guy's handsome, clipped and efficient. He's also completely blank and you get no feeling of anything from him. You're much more drawn to the horrible, craggy features of the serial killer, and he is so unpleasant that you want to see him fucking suffer. You do want to see him suffer, and he does suffer. Mm. Oh my God, he suffers in this film.
Well, everyone suffers in this film. No one comes out of this film unscathed, including the viewer's sense of morality.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, again, out of the films that we've watched, they're all, you know, like I say, they're all twists on the narrative thing. This is a fucking exploitation movie.
Yeah, this leans hard into the exploitation.
This is I Spit on Your Grave, basically. This is much more close to the kind of, like, almost... taking you right to the line of getting off on what you're seeing, you know, and then pulling away, sort of sticking a middle finger up at you. It's too contained to ever feel like this kind of roar of anger. It never really feels that. It's far too mannered. It's far too well directed.
Controlled. Yeah, yeah.
But still, it is. There is a perverse glee going on here, and I can't quite. And like, in common with all exploitation movies, I couldn't tell you whether it's coming from a good place or a bad place.
I have
no idea of the moral compass of this film. Like, and that, for me, is what makes it such a difficult watch. But also, for the same reason as those old exploitation films, one that...
It's thrilling.
It's thrilling, and it sticks in your gut. You know what I mean? It really just stays there like a lead sandwich.
It's a pummeling experience. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I think is hilarious as well is that the violence in this is simultaneously, you know... It's extremely brutal and real, but it's also completely cartoonish and excessive.
Yeah.
In the way that people get their fucking brains beaten out and they still get up. Yeah. You know, there's one bit where you're convinced that he's dead.
Utterly. Like
and
head,
I think you're,
head,
meant to think,
you're meant to think
that.
Well, he turns his head looks like a deflated basketball, yeah, by the end of it. Like.
And yet, you sort of, he gets up and he's still alive at the end of that. And then that's when you realise that you potentially are dealing with the devil, because he's potentially a sort of supernatural.
Yeah.
And it's got that thing that a lot of like contemporary hardcore Asian cinema has, which is just like people just take punishment and, yeah, then just get up. And it's like,
keep
what?
Taking it, yeah.
I mean, the head trauma in this film is just off the charts.
Absolutely.
There's just like people getting their brains beaten in every few minutes. Yeah. There's one bit, and not only that, but it's got that sort of... It exists in a Twilight world where everyone is bad,
yeah,
right? So everyone else they encounter, but largely, is also really bad. So there's a bit where he gets picked up by what you think is a cab driver, and then and there's a guy in the back who's, yeah, like, turns out, no, they're not. No, that's not a cab driver. Those two have murdered the cab driver, yeah, and are going to murder him. And he takes them out spectacularly.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing, that, yeah, sequence. Like, that sequence in the cab is like, you know, probably the...
Bravura is the, yeah, word I want to use.
It reminded me of the cab fight in The Raid 2, and there is, right, no higher compliment.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was an incredible, like, a real, just like, you watch this thing, it's kind of like, hang on, are these guys killers as well? And then it just erupts, and you're like... Yeah. Okay, that was incredible.
And you find out after the fact that they are, yeah, killers, but you, until that point, it could just be a cab,
yeah,
driver and his other passenger.
And even if it was, would it make any difference, yeah, to how you enjoyed it? You,
yeah,
know, that's almost the thing with this film. There is the very slightest sense that it's hedging its bets a little bit, where it is just kind of going, oh yeah, but they're kind of bad people, so they kind of deserve it.
Yeah.
Apart from how it treats women.
Yeah. And that is the thing about this film, is that, you know...
This will be the off switch for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And if someone had told me how much rape there was in this film,
yeah,
I probably wouldn't have. I wouldn't have chosen it.
And it also has just prolonged sequences of women in absolute mortal terror.
Yeah.
And really convincingly done. And it's hard. It's really hard to watch. Because while it is undeniably turning a critical eye on masculinity, mm-hmm, maleness, it doesn't give you a female character that isn't just essentially a victim,
yeah,
at all. Not once. The only person who isn't is kind of fucked up in her own way anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like she sort of enjoys being raped, which
and
is one of those things.
It presents what happens to her as a rape, only for her to basically start enjoying it.
Yeah,
and you realise that actually it wasn't. But it's,
yeah,
still like there's still an amount of hedge betting going.
Absolutely,
you know,
and it's extremely problematic.
Hedging,
and it would be. I like hedge betting.
That sounds like something actually criminal, doesn't it?
Like, well, it sounds like something that happens in Somerset. You,
yeah,
know, like, that's what happens when
the annual hedge bet.
But no, I mean it is. And I think, you know, I think, you know, a word of caution to anyone going into this film.
Yeah.
That stuff is in the film. It's hard. It's really hard to take. And it is, as you say, if my wife had walked in at any point and I was like, I'm watching my homework for Savage Beast,
yeah,
she would have been like, lovely. You know, that's nice. But it is such a well-made and total sensory experience that, you know, that it doesn't quite feel like one of those things where the sole purpose of it is to get off on watching women suffer.
I don't think
that's
it, never
the point
feels like that,
of the
really
film. I think it just commits hard to what it's doing.
I think the problem that I have with this film, and like I said, I did enjoy it. I think this is a really well-made exploitation film. The problem that I have with this film is that its point in the end is basically what I said at the beginning.
Yes.
Is the, if you run with beasts, you know, if you run with the abyss, then the beast gazes back at,
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
you,
yeah,
know, it's the fucking Nietzsche quote, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's basically, after getting through all of that and realising about halfway through that was the point of the film, to get to the film and it being like, and that's the point of the film, was like, yeah, I got that a really long time ago.
Right at the start.
Yeah,
I got that a really long time ago.
And now you've basically just been like piling on like water torture.
Yeah.
Because I think the problem...
It's also long.
It's also, yeah, it's 2 hours and 18 minutes.
Yeah.
The thing is, if you are using this kind of extreme ultraviolence to the point of a philosophical treatise, then the film that does that amazingly well is Martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
Martyrs is a fucking incredible film. It's unbelievably bleak and relentless. It's incredibly violent towards women, but there is a point there.
Mm.
And it's really odd that most of the fans of Martyrs that I know tend to be women. Mm. They tend to be people, you know, female genre fans tend to really love that movie, mm. in my experience. This film is no Martyrs.
Mm.
It's not as good. It's not as philosophically grounded. It's not as direct. It's much more splattery. It is much closer to something like Last House on the Left, where it's like, was there a point? And they'll go, anti-rape film?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's
anti-war?
Oh, it's about Afghanistan. There is a point where those excuses, you're just like, enjoyed making a gory movie and then you came up with a thing afterwards. And the good thing about doing that in the revenge narrative, you've got your big point already there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You can just do whatever you like, and it's like, oh yeah, man, but it turns you into a beast. Hey Dan, before you start on a journey of revenge, dig two graves. See what that means. It's because he's dead too. And it's like, to get after all of this atrocity, to get to that being the point which you'd already realised was a bit like, you're kind of pulling my leg here. Especially considering this is the same director that made A Tale of Two Sisters.
Well, this was the thing I was going to say. I was genuinely astonished when I looked at the filmography, because I was talking about this in a separate conversation recently about J-horror, and like, when the J-horror explosion, I understand that Tale of Two Sisters is Korean, but when the J-horror explosion happened post Ring, Hideo Nakata's Ring, or Ringu, there was a slew of, I think it was Asia Extreme.
Tartan Asia Extreme. Yeah.
They just chucked out any film which had what we will call a stringy-haired ghost girl in it. You know, the shuffling, like, sort of demonic presences. Because, you know, the Japanese just basically went, I'll show you how to do a ghost fucking story. You know, having endured a ton of terrible American, you know, post-Amityville ghost stories. We got a real, like, game changer when Ring happened.
Yeah.
And it ushered in a whole bunch of them, you know, Pulse, The Eye, all this stuff, you know, Dark Water. And
we'll do a show on the Asia Extreme.
I mean, I love it.
There's so much
Tale of Two Sisters came out, and a friend of mine gave it to me to watch, and it's an incredible film. It's really good, because what it does is it takes that sort of stringy-haired ghost girl ghost story and marries it to a really complex familial melodrama.
Yeah.
And is a really female film. It's about two sisters and a stepmother and all this stuff. And it's very, very complicated, nuanced, and really quite... Now, I'd like to watch it again.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to know whether I watched it a long time ago, and I feel like maybe I might be like, oh, yeah, it turns out it is more problematic than I maybe realised. But I remember not feeling like this was a director who was, you know... had issues with women, per se. I
certainly don't remember that from Tale of Two Sisters.
And it's really, you know, the only thing that this film has in common with that is that they're both very well made.
Yeah.
But it was a real shock to go, oh, he made that? Yeah. Fuck me. You know, this is a dark, dark movie.
I mean, I haven't seen, because there's a film in between, there's a weird western he made called The Good, The Bad and The Weird, which I must say I'd be very intrigued to see.
I mean, it feels like that title was made for you.
Yeah, basically. That's definitely something I imagine I will enjoy. The striking disparity between Tale of Two Sisters and this, but which is what makes me think, okay, well, there's got to be a point here. There's got to be something. Is there something that I'm missing in this film? And I think I would have to watch it again, but to be honest, Dan, it's going to be a while.
It's going to be a while, just going through that again. I mean, what I would also say is this, it points to, and having just, you know, watched Parasite and Snowpiercer, you know, I think that South Korea is making the most exciting cinema in the world, and probably has been for the last 10 years.
Yeah, Train to Busan as well.
Like. Yeah, Train to Busan is incredible. You know, while this was, it's 10 years old for one thing, it was so well made and so brilliant, and I just thought, this is streets ahead. Even though it's disgusting and unpleasant, it's streets ahead, just in terms of filmmaking, than 95% of Hollywood films.
It's in
streets ahead.
It's interesting. Did you get a David Fincher vibe from this movie?
Well, I was just about to say, when we were talking about how films that essentially serve no other purpose than to make you feel bad, Fincher is the archetype of that, because Seven, which is an extremely lauded film amongst a certain sort of group of male film fans.
Is I'm one of them. I really like that.
No, I mean, I think Fincher's incredible.
It's my favourite full-length Nine Inch Nails video. Right?
But Seven is a film that is, you know, utterly juvenile in what it's really doing. It's it's just going, I'm going to make you feel bad. you know, and it's also, my big problem with Seven is that it's that particular ilk of serial killer movie where it goes, the serial killer sees the truth.
Ah, yeah. But actually, have you thought about what he's really saying?
Yeah, and you get the feeling that the filmmakers are 100% on the side of the serial killer, which I find really unpleasant. Now, in this film, it verges on that.
Yeah.
But I think what it does really well is it goes, you know, and that title again, I Saw the Devil, he is the fucking devil. And there's a wonderful moment where he's being tortured again by the hero. And he starts whimpering and begging for his life. And you think, this is a bit unusual. He doesn't seem like that. And then he just suddenly just looks up and is just like, you're not going to make me feel bad.
Mm.
I don't feel bad. You haven't won.
Yeah.
This isn't, I'm not, I don't feel
You've already lost everything.
And that, to me, is if you're going to say, what's it like to look at the devil, you know.
Mm.
And you know, the devil as a concept is a complicated and nuanced thing, but if you're going to say that the idea of the devil is the ineffable face of evil, you know, that you cannot comprehend and cannot deal with, it's done brilliantly there, because you're just like, this guy's still looking at you going, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad. It doesn't matter what you do. Mm. And it's terrifying. Genuinely terrifying.
It's also that thing where he's sort of, yeah, it's amazing that scene. And he's also sort of saying to him, it's just kind of like, everything that's happened now is just because of you, because he kills other people close to him as well. It's just like, and it's similar to Blue Ruin. It's just like, well, you're in this thing now, and you're dealing with a force beyond your control.
Yeah.
And in Blue Ruin, the force is, you know, revenge itself is the concept of revenge and how it sucks everything in.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas this is just like, I am the actual living personification of evil. If you just left it, most of your friends would still
be alive. And the other thing, of course, is by doing what he does, this cat and mouse thing where he keeps kind of, the first time it happens, it's really well done, where he captures him, does him over, then he wakes up and he's got loads of money, because he's given him some money so he can kind of get by, and that's really like, at first you're like, I don't get it, he's going to catch him again. But of course, in doing so, he nearly, you know, a couple of women are very, very nearly raped.
Right, this is the other problem
I know we're meant to go, you see, because isn't he just as bad in a way, the good guy, but it was like, this is really hard to watch.
But that also ends up working against the film, I think, because the problem is He follows this guy with the tracker, and the sort of the two or three times that he catches up with him in the film, he is basically
just about
sexually assaulting
a
girl, or about to sexually assault a girl. So what you end up with is this situation where it's just kind of like, oh, please act fast, Mr. Hero, so you can swing in and save this defenseless woman from the devil. And it's like, and that happens like twice, and it's like, this is actually not doing you any favours. If you're trying to make a point here,
that's why it is a misogynistic film, because there is also a bit where his wife's sister is in it, and I got a feeling at one point I was like, oh, maybe what we're gonna get is that a woman is gonna fucking end this, and actually he will come across a woman who actually he doesn't dominate, and that doesn't happen.
I entertain again, hopes for that as
yeah
well.
And
yeah.
I realised
I was betting on the wrong horse.
I realised that I was playing the wrong game, absolutely. I was like, no, that's not going to happen. But
that's
I
not
did
how
think
this film works.
I think that might have given it a different feel.
Yes,
but what it does do is, I think it comes from a really patriarchal world where it's like, no, but I mean, the man has to stop the other man, because that's how shit goes down.
Mm.
And it that's where you realise that the misogyny in it is deep grained and part of a societal belief about what, you know, which is why the final film we're going to talk about is an interesting comparison.
Mm.
But, you know, that was the bit where I was like, see, it's always the guy saving the day, and that just feels problematic when you've had to witness so much kind of abjugation and just terror.
It made the whole point of the film feel really hollow in the end. And this is my problem with this film. Like I said, it's an exciting movie and I enjoyed watching it. But at the end of it, I was like, this feels fundamentally hollow. This isn't Martyrs. I haven't come out with a greater understanding of the subject matter before I came in. I've just come out feeling awful. And it's like, in that way, it is a classic exploitation film. It is having its cake and eating it. But in a way, you know, it's quite similar. Like when you were talking about Joker in the last thing, you were just like, Joker is a dirge. This film is a dirge, but it's a much more interesting,
kinetic and exciting
dirge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's one note throughout.
Yeah.
But because of its length, and because of the sort of spiral of atrocity that you're sucked into, it remains compelling. Like it has to be the length that it is. I saw a lot of reviews saying, "Oh, you could have taken 15 minutes on that." It's like you're missing the point.
Because I wasn't sure what you'd take out to make it kind of suddenly be
this film is. It has to be this long. It could probably, if you really wanted to make its point, it could be another 15 minutes longer. Do you know what I mean? And then you'd get it. And The problem is that the point is fundamentally a little bit facile.
Yeah.
So it's...
Let's also just say this is a film where there's a subplot involving cannibals and you don't blink an eye.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Oh, that's absolutely bizarre. I mean, but that's the other thing that it reminded me the most of is Hannibal.
Right.
The TV programme Hannibal.
Yes.
Bryan Singer, is it?
No, not Bryan Singer, Bryan Fuller.
Bryan Fuller. It even looks like it at points. It's lit a lot like it. But again,
I imagine he saw.
Yes.
I saw the devil.
I would imagine it was an influence, definitely. Particularly in the scenes where you realise that there's kind of a subculture of serial killers at work in this part of the world. Yeah. Which is actually, not an undone idea, but it was actually introduced quite well into this. But yeah, it really reminded me of Brian Fuller's Hannibal. It had that vibe, and again, that kept me compelled.
But also, I would say Hannibal is another thing where it's stylistically impeccable. It's exciting. It's all those things. But it ultimately doesn't have a huge amount to say.
Yeah,
that's fine. Things don't have to have something to say necessarily. But Hannibal is definitely like one of those things where it's like, don't go to this seeking meaning and substance.
But it's also interesting. Having read around Hannibal, I'm, a huge fan of that programme. In all the interviews with Brian Fuller, he's always like, I deliberately, even when the source, the Thomas Harris source sets did, I never ever touched on sexual violence because I was like, I don't, because then all of a sudden it becomes about that, and you have to deal with it responsibly and properly. So I never touched on it. In this film, it is about that, but it never deals with it responsibly and properly.
No.
So it is like, we're basically, we are forewarning you. This film, if you have a stomach for this kind of extreme genre filmmaking and you've seen Martyrs and stuff like that and you've got what you need out of them, then check this film out.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth it from a historical perspective. Don't just throw it on.
Yeah.
This is, you'll get
more. Don't watch it with your family.
Yeah. In fact, I wouldn't watch it with anybody because it was one of those films, like, even watching it knowing you were watching it at the same time, I you get that thing when you watch a film with somebody and you're a bit like, oh God, are they enjoying it?
No, it was interesting actually because I sat and I watched it upstairs on my own and I put it on headphones and the sound design on it is wonderful. And I actually was like really glad to be watching it on my own and I felt that kind of locked in feeling was completely appropriate. I think if you and I had sat and watched it together, we would have probably, lightened the air by being like, fucking hell, Jesus Christ, But there was none of that. I was just watching it in kind of horrified, compulsion.
Horrified stupefaction.
Yeah. But there were moments where I was like, Jesus Christ. Yeah, not just the sexual violence stuff. I mean, just the fucking trauma, bodily trauma. But you do sort of, this is the problem, is you do sort of enjoy it and you do want to see this guy get fucked up. So you're like, keep doing it. Keep fucking him up. Because
stretch the running time for another quarter of an hour.
Because one of the things I find so problematic, and it's like I say, is why I don't like Seven ultimately, although I think it's, it's a good watch in some ways. It's a tour de force of style. I don't like films that have any kind of empathy or respect for a serial killer. Yeah. I don't like that. I think these people are the fucking worst that humanity has to offer, ultimately, because it's, your entire selfish reason of being is just to make other people suffer, and that's appalling. And so I don't like it. And I think this film just about escapes it. He is compelling. He's far more compelling than the hero. But you are never, ever, ever under the impression he is anything other than evil and horrible and appalling and just the worst. And I think that's perhaps the saving grace, is it doesn't give him dignity and purpose. He's just pure id.
Yeah.
He's just unstoppable, terrifying id. And the difference between him and the guy in No Country for Old Men is that guy is just, his only reason is to kill because that's his job, right? That's what he does. Whereas this guy is not, gets pleasure out of what he does, but what he does is remorseless and unpleasant, and he is never given a speech where you go, oh, perhaps he speaks for us all.
Yes, in many ways.
There's none of that. He is a straight up fucking baddie. He is the devil.
And that's what makes this film, I think. It's that central performance. It's a hell of a movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's a bloody ride, and it's not necessarily a pleasant one.
But it sits really well with the final film.
It really does. In fact, it's going to feel like a breath of fresh air talking about Coralie Fergiat's Revenge from 2017.
Women always have to put up a fight.
Yes, Revenge.
I love this film.
Yeah.
I love this film. I've seen this film a lot.
Right.
This is one of my... There was this beautiful period. I wrote about it for The Quieters. There was this the thing where I was writing about... was 2018 one of the best years for horror ever? Objectively, I think it was. Mm. But there was this period where you had this, Mandy, and Let the Corpses Tan. Mm. And I watched them all within like a month of each other.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the best period of filmmaking I have experienced as a living human.
I have a feeling that Mother was in that.
Mother was in that as well. No, not Mother. Goodnight Mommy was part of that as well.
Yeah, the Austrian film.
Yeah, fantastic. We were two together, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
Fantastic movie. Haven't watched The Lodge yet. Looking forward to that. This film fucking rocks.
Yeah.
This film kicks ass.
The thing to say right off the bat with this is the reason we wanted to put this at the end is having gone through this Dirgy Boys revenge trilogy, we wanted to end with this because this is different.
Yeah.
It is... It's a female revenge.
It's an explicit repudiation of a lot of what we've seen already.
And it's a fascinating film for a number of reasons.
Mm.
But it's also directed by a woman. So it is a woman's revenge on some men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's directed by a woman. And that instantly places it in a different category to everything else we've talked about.
Yes, I've talked about how all of these films are subversive. This is just fucking subversive.
Yeah.
This is just like... This is a completely different spin on it, you know, and it works gangbusters for me, this film. So it's such a satisfying movie.
It's a French film, but it's sort of international, I think. It's got international co-production. Yeah.
Sort of vibes. It was Shudder that picked it up as well, so it's on Shudder if you want to watch it.
Yeah.
It's worth the price of admission alone. Get a free startup and just check this out.
Like. Yeah. But I would say it exists in the sort of French brutalism school.
There's a lot of haute tension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, as there is with I Saw the Devil, there's a lot of haute tension, martyrs.
Yeah,
the less philosophical end of martyrs. There's a lot of that kind of vibe to it. Frontier as well, which is another film. Not as many people have seen that one, but that's a good one. I was really into this stuff when I first moved to London and was working in a... Funny enough, when I was working in a DVD shop, all this stuff was coming out and I was just like mainlining French extremity.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, this is definitely... it's a more sort of pop savvy move on from the new French extremity.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, by the comparison of the rest of the stuff we've watched, this is a fucking feel-good movie.
Yeah. So what this is, first of all, it's an incredibly stylized film.
Mm.
I mean, from the first shot to the last, it is unbelievably stylish and cool looking.
Mm.
And it is also, whilst being insanely brutal, a feel-good movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it is horrible and it's grueling and it's sort of, again, it's one of those films where if you sort of paused it at certain points and went, what am I actually watching at the moment? It's, but nonetheless, you come out of it being like, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Because that's, this is the thing, we're talking about the other three films we've watched and, saying that, this cliche thing of revenge, Dan. You might want to dig two voids in case the beast comes out of the void.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Nietzsche said, This one, the message of this one is revenge is fucking awesome.
Yeah. Take it as quickly and brutally as you can.
So basically, the setup of this film is that Jen, who is the sort of... the affair of she's played by Matilda Anna Ingrid Lutz.
Yep.
And she arrives at this... place in the middle of the desert with her hunky boyfriend, played
hunky,
by Kevin,
super rich
Kevin Jansen, like one total 1% asshole, isn't he? And like you're made aware very quickly that he's having an affair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's they're away from his
wife.
She's
the trophy girlfriend.
Yes, basically. You know. They go to this ridiculous place in the middle of the, I presume, Arizona desert or somewhere like that. You know,
it's completely irrelevant where it's happening. It is a desert basically. It's one of those films that doesn't ask you to care about where things are happening.
No.
It's like it's the desert. Yeah. So you know,
and so they go for this sort of weekend away, and I thought it was very interesting that, as an aside here, Kevin Jansen's character, Richard, the first time you see him, he's prominently wearing a Fred Perry, which is one of the things. I don't know if it's because of the slight right-wing associations, but so often when you see characters wearing Fred Perrys in films these days,
they're
assholes.
Yeah.
Which is really annoying, because as a mod, I wear Fred Perry constantly, and I'm worried that, we scooter-wearing members have been kind of pulled in to these misogynistic assholes. I want nothing to do with them.
Exactly.
I wouldn't wear one that was the colour that he's wearing when he turns up. And so they're hanging around for this weekend, and then his two awful mates turn up to go hunting with him.
Yeah, so he's planned a hunting weekend, and they arrive early. So basically his plan is he has his weekend of shagging in the desert with his hot, you know, trophy girlfriend while his loving family are at home.
Yeah.
And then she is escorted out by helicopter back to wherever, you know, and his mates turn up, and then he has a weekend of hunting. He's got it all.
Yeah.
You know, and they basically turn up a bit early.
Mm.
So suddenly he's got his, you know, totally, I mean, she is presented utterly as a sex pot.
Yeah.
You know, and it's why it's so interesting that it's a woman director, because I'm fascinated by the thought that watch this and think it's a man directing it and see how you feel.
Yeah, until you can't feel that way anymore.
Until it definitely isn't. Yeah.
The way she films her at the beginning is straight utterly, out of the straight out of the Transformers playbook.
Yeah,
low camera following her bum basically for enormous portions of the film. So it's like
you're not given anything to suggest that she's not like just a vision of aesthetic enjoyment.
Yeah.
She's not given anything as a character, and that's what is so interesting. Mm. You don't go, oh, but you know, she's actually this feisty, independent person who just happens to be super hot.
She doesn't suddenly reveal she's a science major.
It lingers on her body, and she is nonetheless, you know, she knows what the situation is. She's a willing participant in this, and the camera just literally hangs on her. And lo and behold, you know, something bad happens.
Well, we should probably, because, you know, this is a rape revenge film.
Yeah.
This is the most cut and dried rape revenge movie that we've got. And that is, you know, that's a subgenre of revenge films in its own right. The boyfriend leaves to go down to town, where the fucking nearest town, who cares? And one of the hunting guys rapes her, while the other guy ignores it. Basically, really well filmed scene.
It's
not gratuitous, but it's horrid. You're not left in any idea about how awful the act is. But the way it's filmed is tasteful as you can be in these things, while still leaving you with a definite impression that what's just happened.
Yeah, she as a director, she chooses to focus on different things to make you feel nauseous. So in that sequence where she's being raped, you don't see her being raped in any sort of way that's exploitative or, you know. But you do see the guy who comes in, and he's just got like...
He's like chewing some chocolate, isn't
he? Chewing some chocolate, and it focuses on his fat, blubbery jowls chewing on some cookie or chocolate. And that gives you a kind of synesthetic disgust.
Gives you more than enough, actually.
To feel appalled at what's happening to her. And I think that is something that a man wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
That's where you start to go, I see, this is clever, this is smart. So she is raped. The guy, her boyfriend, turns up. The
boyfriend comes back. It looks like she's about to ruin his holiday. So her boyfriend, being the worst man in the world, pushes her off a cliff.
Yeah.
So she impales herself on a giant tree, basically. Yes. It literally goes through her middle, doesn't it?
And this is another film, I think, where you are definitely... certainly bodies take punishment that is outlandish, but also there is that suggestion that she dies and is reborn at that point.
Oh, it's more than a suggestion. Yeah. One of the things I love about this film, and it keeps me coming back to it, is that it's really interesting this came out the same year as Mandy, because she has a psychedelic rebirth as a warrior of vengeance. She pulls herself off this tree, and it's one of the most agonising and unrealistic things I've ever seen. It's like, no way, but you're still like completely
good. Yeah, it's like, has it not gone through a spinal column?
She literally hauls herself off a tree in like incredible slow motion agony.
Oh.
Retreats to a cave in the mountain. She's got the peyote that they bought for the weekend in her back pocket. She downs the peyote like a fucking champ. Like, to be honest, if I was suffering that much, I would be like, I don't need to be tripping now.
Yeah.
But like, fair play this woman. She heats up a beer can, which is called Phoenix Beer.
Yeah.
Heats it up over a fire and brands herself with a phoenix.
Yeah, so
to
she cauterize basically
her cauterize, wound.
Yeah, and then has this sudden like imprint of a phoenix on her. Yeah.
The metaphorical levels of this film are not subtle.
No.
But also, it kicks so much ass, bit. It kicks so much ass.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's that moment when you're watching it, you're just kind of like, I can't wait to see awful things happen to those three men. I cannot wait.
This is what this. So this is a rape revenge film that deals in extremely. It's subtle in some ways, but it deals in like these are beer swilling pig men.
Yeah.
Well, two of them are.
Two of them are.
And the boyfriend,
one of them's a bit more metrosexual.
The boyfriend is the worst, of course, because what we get with him when he turns up, we should dial back. When he turns up to come back and finds her essentially in a crumpled heap. Traumatized and post-rape, and realizes in any sane world he's fucking doing something about this. Mm. What he does about it is he goes, let's just get you home, essentially, and offers her a job, these awful things that basically tries to just essentially cover it up, because obviously if it comes out that she's been raped, then there's all these impacts on him, his family, his business, everything, his reputation, his fucking ego is at stake. So of course he just throws her to the wind, and eventually, as you say, literally throws her over a cliff. So what's great about him is he's presented as this ultimate slick, you know, handsome alpha male who's revealed to be the worst, and even the guy who's kind of raped her starts to feel some sense of impropriety about what's happened.
Yeah.
And he doesn't,
he doesn't at all. It's really interesting. When panic sort of starts setting in between them, and they're not sure, he's really cool headed. He's like, no, this is what we've got to do. We've got a problem. We've got to extinguish one.
Yeah.
And you get to know the kind of person he probably is in business. And
absolutely.
He is with his wife.
Yeah.
You really get a sense of what a massive asshole
Kevin Janssen's
his character is. You know, and I really liked that about this film.
Yeah.
It gives enough time to have the three characters kind of develop off their own bat. You know?
And there's another interesting thing we should say is that in the sequence, so the guys turn up and he's a bit like, oh shit, my buddies are here. And she's like, that's cool. You know, we can hang out. They have a night, they get drunk.
Yeah.
She does a kind of, it's a seductive dance for them. There's a suggestion that maybe, is she sort of some sort of, maybe she's an erotic dancer. Maybe that's how he met her.
Yeah.
You don't know. It doesn't say, but she does a kind of like, you know, a kind of sexy sort of dance for them at the pool because they're all drunk and everyone fun, and that's why the guy's looking at her going,
she wants it
basically. Yeah. And what's so clever about that is that scene feels entirely Michael Bay-esque. It feels really male.
Yeah,
it's ogling her, and you're also asked to go, why is she doing that in front of these guys? Don't do that in front of these guys. And you are being led down the path of she kind of asked for it, right?
Yeah completely.
And
yeah,
the point is, no, she didn't.
No.
She can do that. She's allowed to do that. It's fine, right? You don't get to rape her because that happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's again where it's like, this is a woman directing. This is a woman saying this. Right?
Yeah.
She's saying she can do this. She doesn't have to be a fucking history major and actually secretly, you know, no, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You don't get to take her.
Yeah.
That's not okay, right? And that's what's so great about it, because when that happens, and then when you get this joyful and horrible revenge narrative, you just feel good about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You just feel good about it.
At any point, feel that she is, you know, that there's no kind of like, she's becoming a monster. It's like she's becoming a badass.
Yeah.
And every single man in this film is suffering appallingly, and I'm very happy about it. Because, that's what this film is. You know, it's like, it's more than just like turning the revenge narrative on its head by sort of saying like, oh, it's a woman directing. You know, it's actually just going, revenge is fucking awesome.
It is.
And there actually aren't many revenge films that do that.
And,
you know?
And also it's got that great thing where, because it's set in the desert, it does remind you of a Roadrunner cartoon. That it's cartoonish in its kind of excessive brutality.
The sheer amount of blood that these men lose over the course of this evening and morning.
Wonderful.
Like literally at the end, the hallway of this beautifully appointed house.
Yeah.
Like that you cannot see a spot of paint on it. It is literally just splattered with shot wounds. Again, because this is one of those films where you know what I'm like. I've told you about my fear with these movies, where you're sort of watching and you're just kind of going, oh, she's only got to kill three people, though. There's not going to be much blood. It's like, no, they're really stretching it out.
Don't worry.
The bit where the big lad has to pull that massive lump of glass out of his foot.
Oh, yeah.
And it just goes on for ages.
Oh, and he treads on a bit of glass, and he's got his finger pretty much inside his foot, and he's trying to fish out this giant bit of glass, and it's just howling like a beast. It goes
so
on for at least 2 minutes.
Again, it's like, it's a really cleverly, smartly made movie. Like, like, I love this thing, you know, we've been saying that, you know, the big narrative of these things is like, you know, you turn into a beast. And like, you know, when you think of male revenge, you think of like a, you know, the wolf or the bear. She becomes a flying animal.
Yeah.
And so much of her interactions with the male characters after she's become this sort of revenge monster.
Revenge phoenix.
Are her from above looking down on
yes.
them.
Yes. Yeah,
because
yeah.
she gets given a rifle with a telescopic sight. So much of it is her looking down yeah, on them. Do you yeah, know what I mean? Yeah. Like a bird of prey.
Well,
and that's a really interesting subversion.
They become objects to her. She yes. becomes the objectifier, and it's made explicit in the end where he gets back to the house and I think he thinks he's killed her. I can't remember. He thinks he's
something along those lines, yeah.
But he gets back to the house and he's covered in blood. So he goes and gets in the shower. And he's a hunky bloke with a good body. And suddenly, he's naked in the shower, and then he kind of becomes aware that she's there. And so the last 10, 15 minutes of this film, he's butt naked.
Yeah.
And that is great.
It's brilliant.
Because yeah. how many times in a film is a woman gratuitously naked? And this is great because it's like he is gratuitously naked throughout the entire end sequence, and you get to see his peachy bum
yeah.
as he runs away. And, you know,
one of like... my favourite things about this film, and one of the things I find so neat about it, is that it's a film that has a punchline.
Yeah.
And the punchline of this movie is that, you know how you like looking at women in these sorts of films? Well, now look at a man.
Yeah.
Look at a man in that
yeah.
exactly same situation.
Yeah, yeah.
He's naked. He's
having
terrified.
A shower. Yeah,
he's
yeah.
running around the house. He doesn't know, you know, he knows there's someone in the house with him. He's got a nice bum. We're encouraged to look at it yeah. over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's like, this film has a punchline.
Yeah.
And that's the punchline.
And it's like, you know, when has this happened?
Yeah.
When have you ever seen this?
And it's like every time never. I watch it, I'm like, no, I can't think of a single other film where that happens. And for it to be able to do all of this stuff and still be one of the most enjoyably knockabout horror action movies of, like, it's one of my favourite horror action films.
Yeah.
You know, it's right up there. You know, it's right up there with some stuff like Aliens and stuff like that in terms of like how it deals with its horror and its action at a really good level. And the way that it does that is like every time I watch it, I'm like, no, there aren't any other films like this.
Yeah, yeah.
There aren't any more.
And it's like when we were talking about Karen Kusama and how, you know, by simply just reframing the hard-bitten cop on the edge as a woman and basically going, yeah, but I mean, I'm still going to show you kinetic, exciting action sequences. And, you know, she's, you know, it gave it an interesting spin. This is just that, you know, this, if you said stylistically, there is nothing to indicate there's a female director, because of course, why should there be? You can't tell female directors, you can't tell black directors, you can't tell. What you can tell is sometimes from the positioning, the content, the way that they've decided to make a film, but actually just filming things, just shots put together.
It's a passive process.
It's a thing that people do, right? There's no fucking, women don't just make films about, you know, small dramas about, you know, you can make a muscular, kind of stylized, completely hideously brutal horror film. And she does it. She's like, fucking yeah. She goes up against every single male director here and is just like, yeah, I mean, I can fucking do it.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
It's my favourite film on this list by a long shot.
And yet, you know, by simply having this kind of female perspective on it, it just makes it 1,000 times more interesting.
Yeah.
You know?
And gleeful. It has to watch a narrative like this, and especially after watching the other films on the list, to come out of it and be like, I was allowed to take a real sense of glee in that.
Yeah.
Actually feels very genuinely subversive.
Yeah. These guys were cartoon pigs, but they were also, their urges and their views are just go on the fucking internet, look anywhere, you can see this shit everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's not that much of a reach. But what's fun is that by playing them as cartoon characters, by setting it in this roadrunner desert, it just allows you to just exult in the fucking brutality and fun of just seeing them get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
And it's like, good, you fucking deserve this. Yeah, you're remorselessly awful people.
But it's got like a real it's got like a real psychedelic vibe, this film as well. I'm always sad it gets a bit overlooked, because I think this is a really good one-tour with Mandy. Not only do they come out the same year, you've got a psychedelic,
that's a great double bill.
Yeah.
That's a great,
you've got a psychedelically like enhanced revenge narrative at the sort of it. But also this film looks great, and it looks psychedelic in that very Zabriskie Point way.
Yeah.
Like, she's obviously watched a lot of Antonioni. Like, everything's, there's like a crispness to every
shot.
And, you know, all these like
it's not murky psychedelics. It's hard, shiny psychedelics.
And there's loads of these, and again, similar to Let the Corpses Turn in that way, these very stylized things of like blood and insects and it's almost kind of like GCSE surrealism in some respects, but it's just done with such detail and such love that it really pops. I would almost describe it as comic booky, because it has that sort of intensity of visual language to it,
And primacy and sort of
I love the way this film looks. I love the way it feels. It's obviously really informed by the 80s, but unlike a lot of other directors who've dealt with similar kind of stuff, it never feels like pastiche.
No.
It's closer to someone like Lee Whannell, the way he deals with 80s genre stuff, in that
he incorporates it into his...
Coralie Furgiat here, she's learned the best lessons from that stuff and incorporated them and made something that's very much her own. It's a gnarly fucking movie, man.
It really moves. You know, full disclosure, I mean, it's a brutal film. There's some stuff in it that's really hard to watch, but it never feels like a dirge, and it never feels... it's Grindhouse. It's a Grindhouse movie. Yeah. It is, you know. And it's more self-conscious, perhaps, than some of the other films, or at least it's more open in its kind of aspiration to be nothing more than a smart, gendered take on Grindhouse.
Well, it's explicitly a feminist rape revenge film.
Yeah.
You know, that I imagine... I mean, I haven't read around it a huge amount, but that I imagine would be what she sat down. She was like, right, I'm going to do a feminist rape revenge film.
Yeah.
That's the hook. And that is the hook. And it's a really good one.
She will have, as a film student, I want to assume, she's probably read Carol Clover's completely seminal Men, Women and Chainsaws, which is a book that blew my mind. I mean, I read that when I was doing my film studies A-level. And I read it, I wasn't even supposed to be, I think I was meant to be reviewing The Searchers or something, and I just ended up sitting in the library reading the entirety of Men, Women and Chainsaws, because it just blew my mind. Because what that book does is it reclaims a lot of hideous films like Last House on the Left and I Spit on Your Grave and stuff, and talks about why, you know, from a feminist perspective, why they're interesting films.
Yeah.
Right? But I Spit on Your Grave, no matter how you want to cut it, it's not a feminist film.
No.
It's an exploitative film that spends an awful lot of time really graphically showing you someone being raped repeatedly
while making some appalling stylistic choices.
The comeuppance is extremely odd. You know, the way she takes the people out involves sex and sort of, you know, all this stuff. So, you know, but Carol Clover does a really interesting, you know, she doesn't just talk about that stuff. She talks about Dawn of the Dead and all sorts of interesting films. But you feel like Coralie Furgiat has taken that sort of film, that kind of critical theory in, and gone, right, how do I do this to make, like you say, a feminist one?
Yeah.
And this is what you get out the end of it. And it's fucking great. It's so fun. Yeah. It's so fun. And this is one where if my wife had walked in, there might have been times where she might have gone, what is this? Mm. But I would have been like, sit down, watch it.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to know what she thinks of this. I'm really tempted to sort of say, you should watch this. I'd be really fascinated to know how you feel about it.
Lady in Uneaten Savage is a big fan.
Right.
Again, it's one of the first films we watched when we first got together.
I love your date movies.
I know. They are a bit... Every time I mention one on one of these podcasts, I'm like, yeah, that's not normal, is it? We're one of the first ones we watched when we first got together. It was it's impossible not to take pleasure in this film. But I say, you know, it's the most uplifting film with a rape scene in it that I can think of. But it's dealt with so well. It's done so skillfully. And that realisation that you're in the hands of someone who knows exactly what they want to do.
Yeah.
They have a single point to make. There's no scatter. There's nothing... It's like Blue Ruin in that respect.
Yeah.
And actually where Dead Man's Shoes and where I Saw the Devil sort of go off the boil a little bit. Dead Man's Shoes and I Saw the Devil take their eye off the ball a little bit. And they wander a little bit far. Blue Ruin and Revenge have an exact single idea they want to do. This is what happens if someone like you and me tries to do revenge. This is what happens if we do a feminist rape revenge film.
Yeah.
And they absolutely nail it.
Stick the landing. Absolutely. No, I mean, I'm so pleased to kind of end on Revenge, the film, because It was the one I watched the first when we were doing our kind of homework. It was the one I watched the first.
Yeah.
And in a way, I when I finished I Saw the Devil, I kind of wanted to stick Revenge on immediately.
Yes, I did as well.
Be like,
it's so funny.
I want to see some fucking punishment delivered now by a woman. And you get that. And I think it's just fantastic that she's like this completely pneumatic, totally sexy, and complete credit to Matilda Lutz. It's a transformational piece of acting because she starts off in this one place, and then when she kind of is reborn, she just looks different. And I thought what was really interesting, she starts off as a blonde and she isn't a blonde.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the dirt and shit that's in her hair.
The only thing that still stays the same colour is her star earring.
Yeah.
The one star earring she's got left, which every time you see her, it just seems to get brighter and brighter.
And again, it's like...
So many good stylistic choices in this film.
You know, in some ways it's a really kind of crushingly obvious thing to be like, you know, because blonde signifies one thing whereas brunette signifies another. It's something that, you know, David Lynch plays with in Mulholland Drive and all sorts of things. But, and it avoids being kind of... It doesn't pass judgment on being blonde. It just says she's different, right? She's different now. She's not, and women aren't just this thing that you can just pigeonhole and say she is this.
Yeah.
So she starts off as this thing, and she changes in the film, and her performance is great. It's like animalistic. She's like fucking. Yeah. She's feral, you know, by the end of it. But she's never. But what you don't get is this thing of like. She's become a beast. She's become as bad as them. Because, no, she hasn't.
Because she's become. A bird of prey.
Yeah.
It's different. She's not become a wolf or, you know, because it's always framed in terms of wolves and, you know, bears and stuff like that, this revenge narrative. And with her, she's a bird of prey. Mm. She looks down upon them. You know, she's.
And it's interesting that the film starts with a helicopter and ends with a helicopter.
Yeah.
And it starts with sunglasses and ends with sunglasses.
That's true, yeah. See, the only problem with this film for me, the only disappointment with this film is there haven't been a slew of really bad sequels.
Yeah.
I was really looking forward to, you know, the Revengering with her again having to take some kind of terrible revenge. A bit like The Equalizer or something. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would love it if there was like just a series of like direct-to-video sequels of revenge that just kind of only slightly cheapened the initial narrative, but was still just her basically picking off men using a variety of horrible objects.
Absolutely, yeah.
That would be really... And very much in spirit of the kind of film it is. It has that kind of direct-to-video grunge.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I think it's a smart film that is aiming low, in a way. And I don't mean that...
It's a smart film that knows when to play dumb.
We've criticised stuff before for, you know, people consciously aping something too much or disingenuously entering the fray of genre.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what this does. I think what this does is it goes, oh, no, I know what you want to see. Hmm. Don't worry. I know what you want to see with these kind of movies, and I'm going to fucking give you that. But I'm not going to let you have the normal bullshit. Yeah. Right? I'm not going to do that. So here we go. And, you know, much like something like Get Out, which was similarly lauded for being just a really smart take with a totally different perspective that is nonetheless just hugely satisfying.
Yeah.
And you don't have to like be like, oh, I like this because it's like a feminist. It's like, no, I like this because it's a totally exciting horror thriller.
Yeah.
And it's immensely satisfying as a film. And it's just 10 times more interesting than 95% of the other ones you've seen like this because it is a woman directing it and it's a female point of view.
Yeah.
And that makes it, you know, it works. It bangs.
It's one of my favourite films the last 10 years, man. It really, really is. I absolutely love this movie.
And, you know, I think, like we say, that's what's so interesting again about the revenge narrative is that there's so many films. And when we were initially casting out ideas, there was a number of things that, you know, more sort of slightly different takes on revenge that we mooted, but actually it was quite nice to come down on the stripped down, straightforward revenge narrative that is, you know, revenge for the sake of revenge, and just see what comes out when you kind of look at that. And these are four, again, very different and all successful and interesting films that I would recommend.
It's been fascinating watching them all together. I wouldn't necessarily recommend doing what I did, which is doing them all in a week.
Yeah.
That was a bit, I've got to say, I was on my train journey up to London yesterday, and it was like, why do I feel weirdly depressed? It's like, well, because you basically watched nothing but human degradation entire week, Matt.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's been a downer in lots of ways, so I'm glad to end on such a kind of exuberant high point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's probably a good point to end it,
yeah.
So thank you again for listening to The Savage Beast.
Yeah, thanks guys. We're sorry if this one was a bit more of a bummer than it usually is, but we hope you got something out of it.
Yeah, and we will see you next time.
All right, take it easy.
That woman deserves her revenge. And we deserve to die.